Blog Talk Radio.
How many of our Christians?
Yes, yes, yes. The theme from Godfather 2. It's October 19th, 2012. Probably next to Godfather 1. But this is one of the first films where the second one was even better than the first one. I mean to tell you. Now, there is a connection here why we chose to play that. We're going to get to it in a minute. But I just want to say, George, if you're on the road and you're listening, you're heading back to your estate in Simpsonville, Valerie will be here in a few minutes. And we'll probably talk about you. But besides that, The Godfather is a great institution. Nothing went on that Michael Corleone did not know. Every single thing was directed by him. Who does that remind us of? Let me see. Mitt Romney, do you think, Mr. Whattenberry?
Could be. We've got a Republican Party that has become more and more and more lockstepped over the years. They like things just the way they like them. They say things the same. They think the same. Makes you wonder.
Makes you wonder. Now, we've had things where we can say that people have talked about the union stranglehold on their workers, really forced them to put money into the coffers of the Democratic Party. They've said this forever.
Yeah, in the last 2 years, we've actually seen direct action taken in several states where governors have forcibly tried to destroy unions, break up unions, and or strip them from any ability to fundraise or to, you know, disseminate information to their members.
Well, now, isn't there a law that said, rightly so, that you can't put somebody's finger on the button and make them vote for somebody? You can't forcibly have them give money to a fund that you don't want them to give to. I remember I worked for a company one time, and I, well, as a matter of fact, worked for it on Wall Street. Everybody, every week, had to shift money to the Red Cross and to the some other organization, Salvation Army. We had, the envelope came down, and you had to put money in. Had to put money in, and if you didn't, they said, it's doubled next week. Now, this is so this has been going on for years. But the unions don't say that because even if you don't join the union, they still have to represent you because you're a worker. Now, why is it that since Citizen United was passed, the hierarchy of the upper echelon 1% is now in the position of telling their workers that if you don't vote for Romney, you will be seeing me close down the business and or laying you off?
Isn't that directly intimidation?
Do you think?
That's one thing that I've just been amazed at, how we've come so far in this country that now we can say things like that. Because used to, you know, it was pretty strictly enforced. Your employer couldn't tell you how to vote. They couldn't even ask how you vote. They can't even disseminate information at the workplace about voting or parties because it might be seen as some form of suggestion that you vote a certain way. So they're not even supposed to, you know, go, don't forget to vote now, and here's the voter guide. You know, they can't even do that.
Well,
how is it suddenly okay in America that we have these meetings, CEOs get together, and then they go out to their workers, and they're on tape now doing it all over the country saying, you will lose your job. This company will go away if you keep that evil communist Obama in office and don't vote for Mitt. I mean, isn't that illegal?
Well, we're going to get to that because it is now. It has now been let out that there was such a conversation with many of the multi-billionaire CEOs in the country. And guess who made the call? It wasn't Big Bird.
but he was just as tall.
Yes, that, he said that he likes trees.
Right, and he has several dead ones in his front yard.
Right, and his wife has two Cadillacs, but he drives a truck that he likes.
Is it Herman?
Well, let me give you a hint. He has someone with him that has a little peak in front of his head like Eddie Munster. Let's hear from this person.
All right.
And these CEOs, what they have done. This is a report from Michael Shore on Jennifer Granholm.
I'm Michael Shore. Jennifer Granholm will be back tomorrow. The CEOs of some of this country's largest companies are investing in the shady business of telling their employees that if the president keeps his job, they could lose theirs. First up, billionaire David Siegel, owner of the world's largest timeshare company, Westgate Resorts. He's best known for the $65 million palatial Orlando home he and his wife Jackie built, which was featured in the documentary Queen of Versailles.
We never thought out to build the biggest house in America. It just kind of happened.
It's bigger than the White House.
2 tennis courts.
30 bathrooms.
Full-size baseball field.
10 kitchens.
Antique furniture.
90,000 square feet.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not my room. That's my closet.
But now Siegel is telling his employees that he's just a pauper, his very existence threatened by the new taxes the president might impose on him and his company. So they'd better vote him out if they want to keep their jobs. Writing in an email, quote, "The economy doesn't currently pose a threat to your job. What does threaten your job, however, is another 4 years of the same presidential administration. If any new taxes are levied on me or my company, as our current president plans, I will have no choice but to reduce the size of this company." Well, of course, what other choice would he have? What's he going to live in a $64 million home? Come on. And then Arthur Allen, the CEO of an American-based global software company, ASG, wrote a similar whining email to his employees titled, "Will the U.S. presidential election directly impact your future job at ASG?" In a word, yes. The email reads, quote, "If we fail as a nation to make the right choice on November 6th and we lose our independence as a company, I don't want to hear any complaints regarding the fallout that will most likely come." So if you vote for Obama and end up in communist China, don't say I didn't warn you. And, of course, there's the Koch brothers. We couldn't do a segment like this without the Koch brothers. They're already spending hundreds of millions to get Mitt Romney elected. They're also making sure their employees vote the right way, writing in an email to 45,000 workers, quote, "If we elect candidates who want to spend hundreds of billions in borrowed money on costly new subsidies, employees and contractors may suffer the consequences." I'd call this a thinly veiled threat to vote their way or be fired. But I'm not sure it's that veiled at all. Here's the really disgusting thing. Oh, yeah, it gets worse than what I've already told you. The Koch brothers-backed group ALEC, which drafts model legislation for state lawmakers, has actually succeeded in passing laws that make it illegal for public employees to talk about politics on the job. Consider that for a minute. The Koch brothers pushed through a law that prohibits teachers and firefighters and other possible union members to even talk about politics. But at the same time, out of the other side of their mouth, they're telling their employees exactly who to vote for, even claiming that their jobs depend on it. And for all you conspiracy theorists out there, you're right. This is not just a bunch of great minds thinking alike. It appears to be a totally coordinated effort. The CEOs are getting their marching orders from candidate CEO himself, the man at the top of his campaign letterhead, Mitt Romney. He had a conference call with several executives last month, and the audio was just released today.
"I hope you make it very clear to your employees what you believe is in the best interest of your enterprise and therefore their job and their future in the upcoming elections. And whether you agree with me or you agree with President Obama or whatever your political view, I hope you pass those along to your employees. Nothing illegal about you talking to your employees about what you believe is best for the business."
I mean, the things that come out of this guy's mouth are amazing. And join me now to discuss this from New York is Adam Skaggs, senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. Adam, thanks for coming inside the war room tonight.
Thanks for having me.
You know,
okay. I wanted to cut that short a little bit,
but there were direct quotes from these guys. This is your job.
This is your job as a CEO.
What really bothers me about that, not only is it just, in my opinion, blatantly illegal to do these things, but it's also so disingenuous. It's pathetic because not only do we have a situation where the reverse is true. You know, if you look back, we looked on the administrations many times. You see those charts. The stock market, the jobs market, and the entire economy always prospers under Democratic administrations. And it always is robbed and hence collapses under Republican administrations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you want to talk about job losses. When Bush was leaving office, we were falling off a cliff and at about 11% unemployment, or 12%.
And that was the December, January, while the Obama was being sworn in.
Well, that's what I'm saying. At the end of the Bush administration, we were train wrecked. You're talking about, you know, 12. They are complaining now that despite dragging their heels and not doing budgets or whatever else, ignoring all of what construction is doing is not, you know, generating jobs in this country. Ignoring all of that and taking, say that this is just as it is, and Obama is doing what he's doing. We're below 8%.
7.8, which is.
Does it get better or worse? I mean, that's what, even taking them at their value, face value, effectively.
And for our people out there who have been waiting for this for such a long time, we have back with us for who has been on hiatus.
Michael, I got to tell you that my husband loves that tune. He loves that introduction. He really does. He just tickles them all to death, and me too.
Were you able to hear some of that?
Oh, yes. I was on and I heard the whole thing.
I mean, it is, you don't care anymore. It's just blatant.
No, it's absolutely, absolutely blatant. You're correct.
And what do you think is going to happen if he gets in? They're already going to stop the affirmative action. They will throw us back to the 1950s where women had to go in the alleyways with coat hangers.
Oh, yeah.
They will also stop the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
They will definitely stop that because they will have the horses in there to pass any legislation they want. And no matter how you feel about Planned Parenthood, 97% of that has nothing to do with doing abortions. 97% of it. I mean, you know, there are poor women who can't afford doctors because they don't have health care, who have no place else to go for mammograms, for pap smears, for all the things that women really need. That's what they are doing. And it's, you know, they don't receive funding for this. I mean, it is just a propaganda push beyond. And now that we have the CEO himself, Mr. CEO, Mitt Romney, verbally over the air where anybody can copy it, telling the people, hey, tell them if you don't, you're going to live. I mean, this guy, Siegel, who was the head of Westgate, he further said, and I think I played out a clip of that before, I played the last week, where he said that, if you do not do this, I will close down. I will be forced to close my company, but you will be seeing me on the white beaches of Bermuda, retired.
He's just amazing. That guy's just amazing. I can't even begin. I can't even be.
I mean, it's just,
I got mine and screw you.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, so what's happening in your realm? Because you have another whole situation going on.
Oh, I have an amazing situation.
Party. What's the story?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that, I'm the chair of the Cassaras County Democrats, and my term is up next year, March, April, something like that, and I
right.
had no intentions of running again, none. I mean, exhausted,
mm-hmm.
you know. I stayed on
right.
to just get the president elected, and that's it. Well, you know what? Here's what happened. About 4 or 5 weeks ago, June Mabry, who is the chair of the 8th District, called my first vice and asked him to sign a petition to remove me. Okay? to remove me from the chairmanship because
right.
of my support of Antonio Blue. Because, according to her, that was illegal. That I had to support the quote official candidate, and that Larry Kissler was our official candidate. Well, because the primary is over. Well, that be that as it may,
mm-hmm.
Antonio Blue did not run against Larry Kissler. Okay,
no,
Larry Kissler did not come out in the primary. Larry Kissler did not come out and say that he was not going to endorse the president, that he was going to vote to repeal the Health Care Act, and neither did he vote against Eric Holder until after the Dagenham primary. Okay, so we just like, wait a minute now. And then he voted against the woman's right to choose, the late-term abortion thing. All of that occurred after the primary.
Before you go any further, we need to say, those who are listening around the world or wherever you're listening from, we're talking about North Carolina politics.
Right.
And Harris County is in the 8th Congressional District, which
right.
we have now, Congressman Larry Kissel, who is the Democratic Congressman, supposedly Democratic Congressman.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
and can you explain to the people that are listening why Antonio Blue is now running as a write-in for the Democratic Party?
He's running because he and a group of other people who recruited him to run. I didn't recruit him. Other people recruited
right.
him to run.
I did.
Antonio believes in supporting the president. He believes in, in fact, he was a delegate to the DNC to support President Obama. And he believes in not only supporting the president, but he believes in the Affordable Care Act, and he believes in the Democratic platform. And if you look at Larry Kissel's record, he votes more Republican than Walter Jones, who is a Republican. But again, be that as it may, were it not for the fact that Larry just kept his mouth shut, not done anything, not said any of these stuff, most
mm-hmm.
likely, you know, we would have just gone along and voted for him. I mean, I wouldn't say most likely. I would have just voted for him and said, well, that's it. But then he comes out and he does all of this stuff, and I think, wait, don't do this. Please don't do this. And he's doing
mm-hmm.
it. When I hear him, when I saw him on the in the paper saying he was not endorsing Obama, I went, oh, please, no, tell me you didn't do this, Larry Kissel.
You're right.
But anyway, the bottom line.
But you need to explain, everybody. We were on the board. We were on the 8th District Board because I was the first vice chair of the 8th District, along with you, who was chair of Cabarrus County. And we asked Larry Kissel to explain his position, and he would not even meet with us.
He wouldn't even speak to us. Exactly. He would not speak to us. So the bottom line, see, here's what happened. So then, you know, June Mabry, of course, she decides that I'm wrong, and I'm bad, and I'm the beast, and I need to, whatever. So she calls, she solicits a member from Cabarrus County, somebody from Cabarrus County, to file a complaint. That's wrong. That is absolutely wrong. Because any complaint about somebody in the county must generate from the county. It must start in the county. It must be requested by somebody in the county.
Okay.
Not
and Grace,
chair.
Grace,
come
hold on. Hold on, Grace. Well, we got to explain that who June Mayberry is. She's the 8th
district
chair. Right. Our redistricting was made up of 10 counties, which included Mecklenburg and Cabarrus counties. Mecklenburg is the largest county, but there's 10 other counties involved. Now with redistricting, Mecklenburg County has been kaput except for two precincts. So the bulk, they have additional precincts that were added, but they are more right-leaning, Republican-leaning.
Mm-hmm.
what's happened is that in order to win back his win his seat continuously, he has Larry Kissel has gone more right wing.
Yeah.
And we have spoken out about that, and they are now trying to get you out of your chairmanship position because
right.
you have spoken out about it.
Right.
All right, now you can continue.
Okay, so for any petition, any complaint or petition to remove anything like that about a county office must be generated and must originate from the county. The fact that an 8th district chair came into, here we are now, and when this occurred, we were 26 days out of the election, okay? The fact that an 8th district chair comes into my county or any county to stir up a hornet's nest to get this petition to remove done is completely unconscionable in and of itself. She stirred it up,
right.
okay? She is the one who called John Price. John did not call her. I mean, this is absolutely unconscionable. She's the one who said to
right.
everybody, she's the one who said to people, the state is getting ready to file charges against Grace, but it would look better for you if you dealt with it on a local level. This is the lie that was perpetrated and told to people of my county. And
mm-hmm.
nobody confronted me. Nobody told me about it, or I would have told them, listen, this is a pile of garbage. They believed her. Why? Because she's the chair of the 8th district. So they went along. Well, and they also intimidated one of my members. They would not let her leave the room until she signed the paper. They would not let her. Do you hear me? This is kidnapping. They would not let her leave the room until she signed the document. But the next day, she sent a letter saying, you take my name off this thing because I don't appreciate being intimidated. Okay? And then John Price sends a letter saying, sent an email saying, you take my name off the list because I don't appreciate being lied to. Now.
Go ahead.
Look, Grace, we have the petition right here in front of us. Mm-hmm. And one question that came up last week when we read over it. Now, despite the fact that, you know, here they are coming in from outside and forcing people to do this, but reading the petition itself directly,
mm-hmm.
they quote the plan of organization, and they give the exact paragraphs that are grounds for removal. Okay? And I wanted to read an excerpt of this real quick. It says, any officer or committee member of the Democratic Party at any level which gives support to, aids, or helps any opposing political party or candidate of any opposing party, or who refuses or fails to perform his or her duties, or who is convicted of a crime involving moral turpitude, may be removed from office.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how, even if they dislike what you're doing, even if they want you to support Kissel,
mm-hmm.
how does this apply
mm-hmm.
to you?
It doesn't. It says...
must be directly or indirectly supporting an opposing political party. And you're not. This is a Democrat.
Exactly. But their claim is that in supporting Antonio Blue, I am providing comfort, aid and comfort to Richard Hudson. Bull hockey.
No, Kiss has provided comfort to the enemy. I mean, he's the one who's voted repeatedly to oppose everything that Obama does.
So I asked, I said, wait a minute, you want me to support Kissel even though he's not supporting my president? Here's the answer I was given, and I hope you guys are ready for this. I hope you're sitting down. Here's the answer
okay.
I was given. Kissel does not have to support the president, but you have to support Kissel. Are you sitting down?
So you're expected
yes.
to support one who does not support the
correct.
President of the United
correct.
States and does not support the Democratic
correct.
Platform.
Correct.
And if you do not do so, then you're in the wrong.
Then I'm in the wrong, right.
Okay. But again... even given if there's any possible... they're mad about this, they don't like it, they whatever. How can it be a grounds for removal when the statement is you must directly or indirectly give support to an opposing political party? There is
mm-hmm.
no such action. So it is valid... even what they quote.
Exactly.
Okay, so where do we stand as of right now with it?
right now, it, you know, it won't even come up before the Council of Review. If it comes up before the Council of Review, it won't come up until next year. My term is up next year. So the question, this begs the question, then why go through all these shenanigans knowing that I am not running for re-election next year? Why go through all this? If it isn't to intimidate, it's to intimidate, it's to suppress, and it's to say you walk the line or else.
Right.
That's it.
And that's the whole point. It's the intimidation of the people in this election right now, because even if you were completely in the wrong, again, this wouldn't even occur until next year.
Correct. So why bring it up 26 days, 1 month, whatever it is before the election? Makes no sense. Not at all.
Okay, so what are we saying? That these they're incompetent? I mean, what are we saying?
We're saying that clearly this is intimidation.
What is voter intimidation? It's ridiculous.
But you have not heard from the chair of the party. So this has been something that has perpetrated by the chair of the 8th Congressional District.
Absolutely.
And but what would be the purpose? I understand it, but why would she? What does she plan? Is it something that she can get out of this by trying to intimidate you?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I honestly don't know. I mean, I hear that she has higher aspirations. I don't know. I can't answer. You know,
okay,
I can't answer. And by the way, just to just throw another spanner in the works, okay? The same day that this petition was signed, the same day, that afternoon, just a couple of hours before the petition was signed, several of those people who signed that petition met privately with Barry Kissel.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. Yes.
You know, it's funny how all these things come out. We're Larry Kissel meeting privately with the conspirators and Mitt Romney meeting privately on the phone with his other CEOs and privately in someone's house in Florida and talking about the 47%.
I am not saying, and I want to make sure everybody understands, I am not saying that Kissel was behind this, or Kissel, I'm not saying that at all. In fact, I hope to goodness he wasn't. You know, I really hope to goodness. But what the heck was happening here? It just, you know, this sequence of events is just ridiculous. What was he doing meeting with the very people who signed the petition? The petition, by the way, was written, the petition was not even written by the board. It was written by somebody completely outside.
Well, hold on, Grace, hold on just a minute, because I think this could answer it.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Do you think the shadow does know?
I think the shadow.
Who is the shadow?
Even if you're saying give Mr. Kissel a shadow of a doubt, why would he meet with the people who were writing this letter and trying to do things when he would not meet with the official 8th District Board when they were trying to meet with him?
Yeah, you think?
So he's ducking and dodging then, but he's got time to go meet in the back room with these guys. Now, that speaks volumes.
Well, what all right, so what's the plan from here? Are we waiting for them to throw a left and a right, or have they already thrown the left?
We'll see. I think they've thrown their left and their right, and I don't think first of all, I wasn't supposed to know about this petition to remove until I got slammed with a letter, okay? But unfortunately for them, I found out within minutes of them signing it. Okay, I found out about it before they even sent it up to Tammy Brennan, the North Carolina Democratic Party. No.
I mean, was this the same person that took the video and the audio of the minister down in Florida? This guy must be doing some work.
But the thing is this. I would never have said one word. I would have just let it go. I wouldn't have done. My term's getting ready to expire, guys. I'm working to get the president elected. I'm working to get a bunch of people into Congress that will actually support the president's agenda. So he won't be hamstrung and he won't be handcuffed. Okay, that's what I'm working for. When they pulled this, I said, that's it. Game on. And I said to them, I sent them an email and I said, are you guys really, really going to do this 26 days before the election? Have you even thought about the consequences?
That's why I'm saying I just can't believe that the Democratic chair of North Carolina would ever have been involved with this.
Well, I can tell you
that. Now that you have Larry Kissel meeting with these people, do you know who was at that meeting?
Yes, I do, but I'm sworn to secrecy, and I can't say.
Okay.
So, I protect my sources also.
It was one of those people serving the food that had the audio camera out and the sound camera out, huh? Okay.
Yes.
Well, we will. I guess that will come out in the wash anyway.
It'll come out in the wash.
Well, we want to.
I can tell you that every member of the conspiracy was there.
Okay. Well. All right. So, what? How do you see it in North Carolina for Obama at present time?
Well, at the present time, we're working really, really hard to get the president to be elected. We want North Carolina to stay blue. We want to turn it from this baby blue to a royal blue. And that's the deal. That's what this morning I spent all morning driving people to the polls, and these elderly shut-ins that's what I did is I took people to the polls this morning. And these are all people who will vote for the president. They're very sick, but they want to vote for the president, I told them about absentee ballots. They said, no, they want to go to the polls.
I want to tell you that I have never seen it so crowded at the polls during early vote since I have been voting early. As a matter of fact, last night I had to go to a memorial service for my cousin, and I wanted to go vote. I had my grandson with me, and my wife met me over there at the library. The line was, they had about 150 people in the line. I couldn't wait. So today, my wife stayed in there. She said it took her an hour and 10 minutes to get in to vote. And now this is early vote. And so this afternoon, when I was going to Kinko's to get stuff printed up for the show, I looked at the University Library. Again, there was a huge line. So I don't know what's going on here. We got people coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I think the Pew poll had him up by Romney up by 2 points in North Carolina. But these polls have been swinging so far up and down, it's unbelievable. But I understand now Romney has pulled out all the people in North Carolina.
Okay.
Now, sometimes that means you think that you have it in the bag, and sometimes that means you think it's over with. You're not going to win. So I don't know how what is your feeling as chair in Cabarrus County? What have you seen or heard?
Well, our lines also are very long. I mean, when I was taking people on this morning to the polls, I would drop them off and say, I'll come back. Usually it's 15 minutes or 5 minutes, and I come back and pick them up. Well, I even wait there. But this
mm-hmm.
time, I mean, you're talking 45 minutes an hour, so I was able to make several round trips, go pick
mm-hmm.
up another group, bring them back, take home one group. Yeah. So it's been it's very long, very long line. But then again, the lines are very long. We need to report that. The lines are long because
right.
that's also a form of voter suppression.
Right, absolutely.
Interestingly enough on that this morning, I went down because last night same thing happened to me. I went to my local place. There were lines all the way down around the building.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'll just come back. So this morning I went to another location, one of the libraries, and I waited 2 hours.
Mm.
and barely got in the building in 2 hours. We moved about 30 feet. I finally asked one of the librarian ladies there, I said, what's the problem? I've never seen this type of problem. And she said, I don't know. They don't have the number of machines we usually have, and they don't have the number of helpers.
Yeah.
She said, we only had 4 people show up. We had 2 at the door and 2 doing the machines, which meant 2 people could vote at a time. And
oh.
I said, kidding me. Because I said, then I'm not going to be able to get through here. Because I was already, this was 2 hours into the wait. And she said, oh, you probably got another hour, hour and a half. I went, see ya. But that
was,
right there.
But that needs to be reported. Seems like that needs to be reported.
I'm going to give Michael Dickinson, is our local Board of Election chair here. And I'm going to find out that I'll give him a call after the show and see if there's some sort of this time we have the Republicans in charge of the legislature, so they did provide the funding for the amount of machines.
Oh.
Evidently, that's what I think it is. But I want to definitely find out from Michael Dickinson. All right. Before we say goodbye, what is what's the agenda now for the next to the election, from now to the election? I want you to give us a call next week to tell us where you're at. So what's going on?
Elected. Get the president elected. That's all I'm saying. Let's get him elected. And let's get people in there to support him that will actually get his back.
And okay. how is the write-in candidacy for Antonio Blue?
You just have to write in his name in the congressional.
And how is that done? If with an electronic machine, how do you you can just write in on the electronic machine?
I believe you can. Yeah, if you're voting by electronic, I mean, I don't know because I think that's what it is. Where we are, we're still in the dark ages.
So you also have actual paper ballots out there that you can use?
You have paper ballots that you use?
We do. We have paper ballots.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Greg. But you need to call in next week and tell us what is going on with where we're at with this, because I need to let everybody know. All right?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank
you, and have a good day.
Hold on, Grace.
What?
Hold on, Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Go on.
Grace, I just wanted to tell you this. This was about the petition that was sent in, and it bothered me because I actually know grammar.
Yeah.
This is the level of the people that are coming against you. I just wanted to applaud your work, because their closing statement was, since continues to actively the official Democratic candidate for Congress, we see no other option than to file this complaint. Remove it.
I read that too, and I said, huh?
That cracked me up. I was looking at Mike. I said, this is a joke. And this is the official complaint. Since continues to actively be official Democratic candidate. So I just wanted to commend you. If that's your image, you've got nothing to worry about, Grace.
Thanks.
Okay. And again.
All right. That's me.
And that was Dr. Grace Leem from Cabarrus County. She's the Cabarrus County chair. And, this is so outrageous.
That shows you a good snapshot, though, of what's going on around the country.
Right.
You know, we've been hearing reports all over. Voter suppression here, destroyed ballots there, machines not being shipped here, calling for IDs and that kind of, it's going on nationwide. That's just one slice of what North Carolina is being inflicted with. But this is happening in every state, every county.
Well, at least the 36. No, the 36 with the 36 Republican governors have taken over.
Yes.
Or regressive. I'm sorry, I used the word Republican. I'm sorry. Don't beat me now. But anyway, regressive governors, where they have the regressive state houses.
Yes.
One thing I wanted to say is that we have a situation now where they're cutting the nose off despite their face. As a matter of fact, there was a picture. I saw a picture on the internet, and I thought I had it with me, but I didn't, where this dog in the Philippines saved his master, a little girl, she's 12 years old, from getting hit by a car because she was riding her bike and he was running alongside of her. The car was coming. She didn't see it. He jumped and pushed her and the bike over to the side of the road, and he got hit in the face and sheared off his entire snout. So his face is flushed down, and he just had his bottom jaw. But he's alive. He eats and drinks and everything. So they flew him to, where is he at? He's here at the UCLA, well, not here in Charlotte, but the UCLA Medical Center, Animal Medical Center, and they're going to reconfigure his whole snout. It cost him $20,000. They brought in special surgery there. They have a huge operation at like the Animal Medical Clinic in New York City. And they are going to mold a snout for him.
Rebuild his
It is so horrible, and the dog has such a wonderful disposition. I can't believe it. The dog's about 35, 40 pounds.
Right.
So, but that's what these people do. They're cutting their nose off despite their face because with this voter suppression, it's not just affecting minorities. It's affecting their people too.
Right.
But the bottom line is, you're a minority unless you have some green.
Yep. The bottom line is they will do or say anything apparently to win.
Right. We're gonna just switch up for a minute here because I have a couple of guests here in our home away from home. And last night I went to a memorial service. And for my double first cousin, Marilyn Lawson Gaffney, who passed. And this has been now for how many years? 11 years. And this has been and it has gotten bigger every time. I didn't make the first few because it always I was either out of town or it conflicted with something, but I'll be going to the last last three maybe. Anyway, it is, right now I have in the studio Valerie Gaffney and my niece who's over in the corner playing Crazy Bird or Lazy Bird or Crazy Bird, what is it?
Angry Bird.
She's
probably doing more politics with that phone.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Oh, my gracious, my. Mm-hmm. Well, I hope she's doing the right politics.
She's doing it right.
Okay. So, Valerie Gaffney, tell us something about this memorial service.
It's a memorial service for us because she's passed away at scholarship, but at Carolina's health school, they award these recipients every year, and just as you said, it's getting bigger and bigger every year. I think they added three new scholarships period, and I think from that maybe five new recipients. But we have established, the family and friends donated, and we established the scholarship in her name, Marilyn Faith Lawson Gaffney Scholarship, and it's awarded to a medical student, a nursing student specifically, going to the Carolinas school. But
Williams, what's the first name? Williams was her last name.
Julianne
Williams. Julianne. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she was a recipient this year. Lovely girl.
And she got the award for?
She got our award, and I was trying to remember what our qualifications were. I believe it's going to be a minority, it's going to be a nurse, and it's going to be a need-based.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was awarded. But the evening itself, which was run by Ellen Shepard.
Food was good.
Food was great,
man,
right?
I'm telling you.
Heavy hors d'oeuvres. It was heavy hors d'oeuvres.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sorts of stuff, meatballs. Oh, man.
Stuffed mushrooms.
It was good.
It was really good. It was really nice. And we had it, was that Byron's?
That was the Byron Center.
Where
used to be Spaghetti Warehouse. Right.
Which actually, after my mother passed, that's where we went for dinner.
Right.
Do you remember that?
Yep.
Because there's pictures in that food
yeah.
court. But anyway, the scholarship, the evening is so fantastic, and it's the reason why I invite friends every year to see it. Because when you get there, these recipients, do you remember one lady practicing as an attorney currently, mm-hmm. and has decided to change
nursing. Right.
There was a woman with a Mandarin degree and a Spanish degree. MBA. I mean, these people have these engineer.
One was a mechanical engineer.
She actually wanted to go into nursing with the she wanted to create some type of tool to use in nursing to help patients in different.
And how about the young lady whose husband got in a terrible accident and. The something with the veins in his leg, and she was there because it was a long operation, and she stayed there for hours and hours, about seven hours, right, ICU. She never left his side. She said she changed her whole job description and said she's going to become a nurse.
And that was based on the care. She saw given to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And she just thought this was, there was nothing else she could do. She had to do this. She was so moved by the experience that she just had to do it.
Well, I want to tell you something, right? And nursing, I don't know where they went. We used to be flooded with nurses, but we are in desperate need of nurses. My wife, who's been, I don't know if Marilyn and her saw at the same time, about 35 years, 40, 50 years, 100 years. I don't know. Anyway, but she's been a nursing forever. And well, her and Marilyn, they start at the same time? About the same time. All right. So she's an RN. She has a master's in it and everything. But the thing is that there are no nurses. She now works for the VA. And when you start work, and they cut the hours because this is another thing, that this horrendous, outrageous, regressive legislature that we have in the federal government, they have cut the funding for federal programs so bad that our servicemen who have given up their lives, who have given up their arms, their legs, their eyes, their kidneys, everything, they cannot get the care that they should be getting because there aren't enough nurses. And why there's enough nurses? Because they're cutting them back. They're not paying them what they should pay them, but they're also cutting the hours. Now, when you have someone who's sick, how can you cut the hours? I mean, it just can't. Can you hear on that one? Oh, okay.
But you know what's interesting also, you know, how we speak of teachers. You know, these teachers, they're not getting paid enough. They're not being paid. I mean, they're buying notes and pencils. You know, now nurses, which used to be a guarantee for you, and you got a job, you weren't concerned about it. You go anywhere and get a nursing job and be paid well for it. And there's a concern for that. We have a cousin who went in the hospital in Florida 2 days ago, and, you know, he didn't have proper insurance.
Right.
And, you know, the question was, can we put him in or not? I mean, the man couldn't walk, he couldn't breathe, and they're worried about putting him into care.
Right. Because we have no comprehensive national health care. The problem is you get what you invest, right? And if you don't invest in the future, you have no future. And I don't understand, I've never understood the Republican mantra of let's cut everything. When you cut everything, because my mother was a school teacher, both my grandparents, school teacher.
And my father.
Okay. My entire life, I've seen them cut funding to schools, cut funding for teachers, cut funding for everything. You know, I see all the time teachers, they're begging for help because they have to pay for everything. They have to buy the books, they have to buy the papers, they have the supplies, you know, everything for their students. Same way with nurses. We have some fantasy in this country that you can not invest in anything. You don't invest in the future. You don't help children become better students. You don't help teachers teach children. You don't help nurses and doctors take care of patients. And yet everybody just will somehow magically take care of themselves and it'll get better. How is that even feasible?
It's just not.
No, it's lunacy.
Yeah.
I think that we're going to hit a wall eventually if we keep down this path. Just like we have now a dearth of nursing. you know, my wife's mother was a nurse with the VA, just like Mike's, and she was having to pull, you know, routinely every single day, 12-hour days, 18-hour days. She'd always have to go in. Now, she worked up to become a director, you know, ran the whole floor. She had to constantly cover for nurses because they didn't have enough nurses, you know, so she would have to work her shift and theirs, you know, things like that. It's insanity.
And do we really want tired nurses drawing our blood? I mean,
oh, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You need to think about
that's what, you know, it affects not just, you know, do you get care? It's the quality of care.
It is.
And it's the same way with these teachers and everything else. You know, when you have 10 children, and you can take care of it, and you have an assistant in the room, and you have all the books and supplies you need provided, it's a lot easier to educate someone and pay attention to a child's needs. If you're overworked, having to cover everything, have no assistance at all, you paid for everything out of your own pocket, and then you got, what, 40 kids in the class or whatever, you know, there's no hope of teaching those kids. Same way with nursing. If you're exhausted, been on, you know, 20-hour shifts, and it's the, you know, 13th week of that, you're toast, and there's nothing you can do. It's not your fault, but you're going to make that, or something's going to happen.
You're going to fall through the crack, or you just can't go down and answer the guy who buzzes every time. You know, and at one time that you really needed something is the time you didn't answer, or, you know, just little things like that.
I, you know, for you know, close to the time since my mother's been gone, I have suffered with chronic, you know, and epilepsy.
Oh, wow.
I've these men and women who served us, they are always on. They were always attentive. They were, you know, always trying to be better caregivers. And yet, if you were able to get out of the bed, it was all. You could hear their supervisors, you know, giving them rules and what they could and couldn't do, type of thing. So it's hard. And they're good people, and you want them to have support. And, you know, where they're dealing with people with medical situations, they're also dealing with families, dealing with their family situations. And, you know, these men and women need to be compensated. They need to be praised. Be awarded. It's not an easy profession. Just like you think, it's not an easy profession. And my mother, she taught nursing, you know, and she worked at CMC and worked in their behavioral health department, and she was, you know, a big wig over there. And this was her challenge to keep her staff, her nurses motivated to want to be there, to want to do what their heart says to take care of people. So it's just, it's a hard road to go. Currently, I am a life coach, and my life coach is specific to chronically ill patients dealing with wellness now, to make decisions about going forward, and for them to come out of the chronic illness and the things they were dealing with and be happier and moving forward in their lives.
Well, you know, I can't hear, but I can hear me. But anyway, what is pulling out the headset here? I don't know what I did. I did something. But anyway, what is is there a sort of a set package for the scholarship? What's the scholarship? How does that work?
It's different for everyone. I think this year our scholarship is between $700 and $800,
mm-hmm.
and the scholarships are based on how they're funded. So they have to be funded at the front to have enough money so that they can continue to pay out annual scholarships with growth. And so it's just going to depend. I think there was a scholarship last night for $3,000. I think there was a scholarship for $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
So the scholarships are varied. But, you know, I think Scott Kerr over there is the one who was able to handle all
right.
their financing
mm-hmm.
and figuring things out. I mean, the man is insane with numbers. I just can't even imagine how he does it. I've seen him do amazing things.
He needs to get over and do the budget.
I'm telling you, I've seen this man do amazing things with money. It's just it's incredible. But we as a family, we don't do anything more than show up annually. Our friends, family funded the fund early on. My father, George Gaffney, who is head of the fund, you know, he adds extra funding. Yes, George. He adds extra funding.
Mr. Gaffney.
Or Chief, okay. Whatever you want.
Yeah.
He adds extra funding to make sure that it stays at a higher level as opposed to a lower level because, you know, stocks are involved with the market and how they've dropped a little. So he's still.
Well, it can't be. Didn't the Minister want us to go into the stock market for Social Security?
Yeah. So,
yeah, okay.
Yeah, not a good idea. Hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, they have a great program over there, and, you know, the scholarships they have are vast,
mm-hmm.
and this is just an annual, our award reception that we give out. As you said, it's gotten bigger, it's gotten nicer, it's gotten bigger.
Yeah, well, you had to change the location.
Change location because
it got bigger.
It's got bigger.
Right.
And it was very nice. And again, I bring my friends because I just want them to see these people because they give you the backstory of who the scholarship is named for.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're able to get a background from, I think they said their first graduating class was 1944.
40, yeah.
And, you know, that was the first graduating class. And there, I think there's probably three or four scholarships for the class of 1951.
Mm-hmm.
That class joined together and have created a scholarship that they pass on quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the ladies was there last night to present a scholarship that was named for
for the woman that was.
She wore the hat.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
She was the last generation to still wear the nurse's cap, if you will.
Right.
But
I saw a picture of my wife with a hat on.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
My mother has a picture.
And yeah, I saw that picture a long time ago.
But it's fantastic to see why these people wanted to create the scholarship in memory of these wonderful nurses. And then it's fantastic to hear these stories of the recipients with two kids and third career and, you know, getting it in. I don't know how to do it. I really don't. It's hard. I have two kids, and it's a lot. It's a lot to do.
Well, you know, our last phone call guest, Grace Lean, she was a nurse in Vietnam. Oh, yeah. You go to her Facebook page, you'll see her on her Facebook page as a Vietnam nurse.
Yeah.
Yes. That's right. She was a Vietnam nurse. But okay, right. Now, why are you, besides that, you were up here for some reason?
I was up here because my eldest, my baby girl, is looking at colleges.
Baby?
Excuse you?
Baby.
She's looking at colleges, and we've just come
from. Is it time for the bottle yet? What's the story?
We've just come from visiting Winthrop. And, Angela, what do we get? Thumbs up? Thumbs down? It was fabulous. It
mm-hmm.
really was. And it's interesting because we went to a college fair probably a year ago, and, you know, it had all these different colleges. And so me, my husband, Angela, we kind of separated a little bit to conquer as much as we could. Separately, we all three came away with Winthrop a year ago. And then she visited Emory's campus in Georgia. So that became top of the pile. Then she visited. And
no Harvard? I guess there's no, what do you call that thing you have to get in there with the people who have been there before?
Legacy.
Oh, okay.
And then we visited NYU, which is still on the top of her brain. We went to Washington Square Park. And the guy.
Your uncle was there.
Look around all these buildings. So basically, we own the park. And then there was a hot dog stand to the left. She's like, I'm done.
Yeah.
I'm staying. I'm here. I'm staying. And then we went to Winthrop today. So we're being challenged with, are we going to do Winthrop for undergrad and NYU for grad? Because she wants to go to PhD in psychology. And so that's a long road to hold. Can I say
good. PhD? And you can work on your uncle while you're there.
Yes, please. Oh, my goodness. Please. It's a lot. So, yeah, but she loves She loves the New York atmosphere. She loves, you know, just the culture, the theater. The
everything. Yeah, but it costs $9 for an icicle.
An icicle that falls off the building.
That's right. We're not talking about an icicle in a cart selling ice cream. An icicle in the store is $9.
So, and yes. Qualify for all the above. So it's fantastic, and it's kind of, you know, we kind of have to figure out. And we went with two of her friends and their mom, and, you know, it was good to know they were feeling the same way we were feeling. It was, we all had the same opinion. And then what the biggest height was going to the cafeteria, and the cafeteria was all, I'm telling you, food was so big on this thing. So all you can eat is how they eat. And they have pasta stations on campus. So they have, that's their cafeteria. So listen, they have all you can get, a pasta station, a pizza station.
Is it NYU?
No, this is at Winthrop.
Oh.
At Winthrop.
I ain't think they had that at NYU.
No.
I get it great.
A pizza station. You know what I had today? They have the best turkey and mashed potatoes. It that mashed potato rivals my own Thanksgiving wrap, and I don't say that out loud often. It was fantastic. And then they had the burger joint, and then you could go somewhere else, and they had Popeyes on campus, Starbucks on campus. And then they had the movie theater on campus, which they show 2 days a week, the movie between the movie theater and DVD. That's what they get. So
I got 2,000 films in my home library. Maybe I could go there and do a film festival.
And the campus was beautiful. The campus was beautiful.
One floor of the cookies. That's right. That's right. That's true. Okay. So while waiting for the other guests to arrive here, my daughter, supposedly, she's supposed to be coming too. But anyway, yeah, text her and see what the hook deal is. But anyway, yes. Okay. So it's almost dead. Yes. Well,
yeah.
Come on the phones here. Come on. What do you mean? Hey, how far is Winthrop from here?
It took us 25 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. Though.
Rock Hill.
Right. North going towards Salisbury.
Well, it was actually south.
So it's
177.
South. 177.
Yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, coming back here this way, there was a vehicle underneath the bridge right before the Carolyn's exit and completely engulfed in flames. The whole front of the car was flaming. And then I was concerned because it was under the overpass. So we called 911. They said they had already gotten a call about it. But, I mean, I'm concerned that thing is going to blow up. And it's going to blow up under the overpass, so it's going to explode right in there. It's dangerous. It's dangerous. Yeah, it's dangerous.
Is there nothing you want to say with the crazy bird? With the crazy bird?
Angry bird.
My grandson plays that thing all the time. He knows how to play.
Yeah,
but
he played it on my computer last night,
on
my iPad.
Yeah, after he turned it to negative. But anyway, so what's the story, Angela?
You got
to come on the microphone. Can't hear you. Winthrop. You liked it. Is that the final? Is that your final answer?
No.
Oh, that good. Of course, there's no object. You got your grandfather, right? California. Yeah, but see, once the earthquake hits, it's all going to be beach in Oregon. It'll be beach. So if you go west of Oregon, it's nothing but beach front. So forget it. That's it. Okay.
She loves the theater, and she loves...
The theater. What kind of theater?
She loves
theater,
Broadway.
Legitimate?
Yeah, she loves Broadway.
Oh, you love Broadway.
And she loves musicals, and she...
Well, I have to watch it.
And then she gets the soundtracks for every play we go to. And
oh, well, listen. That's not weird. That's not weird. Because, see, when I was in school, high school, Wingate High School, which was the newest school in the entire country, when I went there, I know it represented U.S. schools at the Brussels World's Fair, in the 56th Brussels World's Fair. Anyway, they had a huge library because it was almost like a performing arts school, but they had a performing arts library of every Broadway show on back then they had records, 78s, and the big ones, which were the 33 to 30s, but they had a library, and I used to go in there for lunch and play all the Broadway shows. Well, I grew up in your grand aunt, whatever it is, my mother was a theatrical agent. Anyway, I used to play all the Broadway show tunes, and especially Fred Astaire. Loved all the Fred Astaire movies. And that's what I used to, I just loved it. And I was put on the headphones, listen, my whole 40-minute lunch. I eat my lunch right in there. So that's where I started from baseball.
We all like the classics. I mean, I grew up listening to Kill the Rabbit. I mean, come on.
Yeah, Kill the Rabbit, right. I mean, especially this one.
Hello, I am Elmer J. Fudd. Republican commentator Rush Limbaugh has endorsed me to replace Mitt Romney as the Republican nominee for president. Like Mr. Romney, I am a millionaire. I own a mansion and a yacht. I have not released my tax returns, and I have no political convictions, although I do love guns.
Now, Elmer J. Fudd, he says he likes musicals too. So I think you need to take Winthrop because it's a beautiful campus. It is a beautiful campus, and you'll be close. And believe me, if you go to New York, you got to be like your uncle, and you got to hire off the Craigslist for roommates.
Craigslist, you get roommates, you get dogs, you get cats.
Absolutely. You get anything on Craigslist.
Anything you want.
That's
right.
You know what? That's true, too. Right. And so
killer.
The Craigslist killer, yes, you can get that person, too. But anyway, we will just wait and see what the – did you text your friend?
I did.
My friend, my daughter. Okay. It is 88 – Moments of Coaching. Life Coach Valerie Thomas. Do you know this person?
I've been missing, Mike.
Oh,
I've never had a life coach.
Yeah, well, hey, I've had a baseball coach. I've had a basketball coach. I had a football coach. But I never had a life coach. Oh, yes, I did. When I got married.
Yes.
I got a life coach. She tells me all the time, you will do this.
See, now that
or you will not make it. In the pros.
That life coach, she tells you what to do and how to do.
That's right.
A regular life coach.
Now, what does a regular life coach do?
A regular life coach is in a cooperative relationship with the client.
Yes.
And so it's for any aspect. I focus on chronically ill patients coming into wellness. So they've been dealing with chronic illness. They've been dealing with the pain, the struggle that people can't see by looking them in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And they're challenged. They're challenged with how do I go to work, with how do I get things done, how do I push through it. And I am there to help and support them. I'm able to support them in what it is that they want to do and how they can get there.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not me telling them what to do. I'm able to help them to figure out on their own what directions they may want to go in, how they may want to capitalize on today because I'm feeling well, and tomorrow I may not be feeling well. So I have to just be happy with what I can do now and not put myself in further strain. But it really is. It's really amazing for me because, I've been dealing with chronic illness for 10 years. Speaking with someone who understands that you don't look sick, but the pain is so horrible that, I can get it. I can empathize. I can get it. I can go to that place with you and help you to see that, there can be another side. There can be going forward. And I work with primary care nurse practitioners, chiropractics, DOs in the area. But all my sessions are all done telebridge. I don't do office visits. I do telebridge. So
over Skype?
Mm-hmm. No, not over Skype. I have a bridge line, I have a phone line, and you come in on that when I give you your code if you decide to be a client.
Well, don't you want to see this person too?
Don't need to see them. And it shows historically if a client will more likely divulge what is really on their minds and hearts if they don't have to look at someone staring at them.
So you mean, you know, you could be talking to the Craigslist killer.
I could. But it's for me to decide that that's a client that I feel is coachable. I'm not just taking someone's money. They have to be coachable. And I would do that through a 20-minute sample session to see how they feel, to see how I feel, and see if we want to move forward together because it is cooperative.
Okay. So now, I'm sitting there the other night, my wife's telling me, you were moaning last night. You were moaning last night. She says, well, I didn't want to wake you up. I said, yeah, because my, you know, my wrist was sore, but I was moaning because the Cowboys lost again. So she didn't understand that. That was not pain of actual physical pain. That was mental pain.
Well, you know what you need to do? You need to log on for South Carolina's Marriage Encounters. It's wwme.org. And Desmond and I just went to a marriage encounter last weekend in Myrtle Beach. And it's all about understanding how to communicate with feelings. So it's not just I'm telling you what to do, you're listening to me. We're actually communicating from a feeling base. I'm telling you, we've been married 18 years, been together 20. It is amazing. When you're married, you do need tools. And, you know, a hairstylist, they go to the seminars and learn new classes, learn new things. In your marriage, you should be doing the same thing. You should be bringing in new tools. You should be learning new ways to communicate. This was one of those. It's fantastic. It is totally nonprofit, and it is donation-driven. And they ask you just a $50 deposit. They're having, I think, another one in Myrtle Beach in February, and they're trying to get one now in either Charlotte or Rock Hill for by June, July. They take about 30 couples a week. It is faith-based. The one we went to was based Catholic, so we did have a Catholic preach there, Father Bill Gaffney. Oh, my goodness, he's changed my life.
Relation?
I told him he was. He was my brother from then. But, yeah, he's from a parish in Jersey and came for this, and he just...
Father Kyle's from Jersey, too.
Fantastic.
But how's that help me with the Cowboys?
It's not gonna
I got
to
call. I got to get Jerry Jones to go down there with me or what?
It's going to help you with your wife and her feeling about your emotions and you being able to play to her. No, honey, it wasn't about moaning and groaning. It's because the Cowboys was on my mind. I couldn't get it off.
But she gets those.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's my feelings. I mean, I can't eat. I can't sleep. I moan. And it was a guy, I saw that path, and I said, what the heck did he do? And I'm moaning. So now, but there are times when I, because you see, I got my hand in the scarf right now.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as we get up on Skype, I'll be able to show these people. But my wrist is swollen. I mean, it's really, see swollen?
Did you do something?
No, it's the third, fourth, and fifth vertebrae, my neck, and the nerve is coming down here. It's only getting worse.
Do you do chiropractic care?
Yes, I do, and it really helps me. And please don't mention because he might be listening. Yeah, because I was supposed to be there three times this week. I didn't go at all.
Let me tell you something.
It was swollen.
In the last 3 months since I've been in a chiropractic care program, meaning there's a course of action, there's a plan of action,
right.
88 visits in a year's time, I have come off of 5 medications. And that's not 5 pills. It's 5 medications,
right.
Which totals
right.
12 pills.
Right.
12 pills are out of my diary right now. I mean, and one of those prescriptions, my sleep medication, which was $112 a month, for him, I pay $117 a month. I've already paid for it.
Right. Well, you know, I get no problem with sleep. Well, I shouldn't say it because I know 3 days last week I was up because the pain was so bad and my pills didn't work or anything else. And then, you know, as soon as I start going back to my chiropractor weekly, like I am supposed to do, he has this machine he puts me on. He used to give me, do all the compression in the machine. It goes up your back
right.
And everything. But now he's got this machine. It's a dipole. No, not the rack.
Mm-hmm.
No, he put me in that too, but this is better. It sends a signal that sort of brings all the neurons and all the.
Oh, it's like a TENS unit.
Yeah, but it's not a TENS unit. The other day he had it. He told me he was fixing. He had to get a new bulb for it. He puts it right on my back for 15 minutes, and my back feels fine after that. So I was feeling these pressures on my shoulders, and he put it up there too. So now I get it 15 minutes on my neck and 15 minutes on my back. It is fabulous. It works, and it took away the pain. I didn't start feeling it for about a day later. I didn't even notice I had pain.
That's big for you because you've been dealing with pain
since 87. Since 87,
yeah.
This is this problem I've had.
Cool.
And sometimes it's so bad that I just collapse like I've been shot.
Yeah.
Boom, fall on the floor. And one time, I remember once, I fell on the floor and I was watching a baseball game in the living room. And I said, well, you know what? I sometimes sitting around, I was ironing. Ironing, you know, and I quickly got rid of that. There you go to the cleaners now. But anyway, I was ironing.
Downy wrinkle releaser. Forget the cleaners. Forget the iron. Downy wrinkle releaser. It'll change your life.
I'm a military person. I need to have sharp creases.
You know what? You're right.
So,
you're
no way. I ain't doing no downy.
Right.
Nothing.
You're right.
Hey, it's got to be sharp. Anyway, so the thing was that I collapsed. Bam. And I couldn't get up. I had to wait for 3 hours. My wife coming to work. And I was still laying on the ground. I said, don't touch. Don't touch. I couldn't move.
Yeah.
So I don't do that no more.
Yeah.
Well, no, I fell. The iron didn't fall. Thank goodness.
It
was just me and Mulder sitting
it's
there.
It's been to the point where you couldn't even touch me.
Yeah.
The pain was
so bad. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah, I know what you mean.
You couldn't jump on the bed.
No, yeah, I know that.
Bed.
But it is terrible. And especially when your lumbar and your cervical area is horrible. But see, that's good that you got rid of five medications.
Five medications.
And a lot of people say they don't believe in a chiropractor. But I've had this particular chiropractor since 1994.
Yeah.
He is fabulous.
But you have to have a chiropractor.
Dr. Turner and Charlotte. Unless anybody listening, you need to go to Dr. Philip Turner and Charlotte off Central Avenue. Good.
Or Dr. Sean LaBelle in Greenville, South Carolina, off of Pelham Road. But you have to have a chiropractor who is interested in your total wealth.
Right, absolutely right.
You can't just go in for an adjustment today.
That's right.
There has to be a plan. There has to be a strategy.
Right.
And there has to be set guidelines. So
absolutely.
I'm on a program. I'm on a plan. I have to do the lumbar to do the neck. And then they check you at 18 weeks with the x-rays again. You have to have someone who's vested
right. And
wants you to succeed. More than you do, and that's what he does. He wants me to succeed. He wants me to be off the medication.
Right.
You know, when I go in for, now if I have a migraine, which I typically have 18 migraines out of a 30-day month. That's a lot. And, I mean, they've gotten better. So
a brain transplant.
They're so much better that I'm not crawling on the floor.
So this has helped.
I now will wait. I will deal with my right. I know how to help myself with my migraines. And when I get to him, I tell him, is it in the front? Is it in the back? He will adjust me within 10 minutes from leaving.
Mm-hmm.
I am done. That migraine is gone, and I have not taken that $9 medication pill.
Mm-hmm.
$9 for a pill.
I think some people forget the medication only masks things or takes care of symptoms, not the cause, right? Your 88 moments, is this something that you're talking about applying to life?
Definitely. This is the 88 moments of coaching. It's the number 88 is significant for me, but anyone can take 88 and find 88 things that you need to do to put you back into the workplace, 88 steps that you can take to put you back in the life. You know, when you're dealing with chronic illness, a lot of times you cancel your social life. You don't go to put everything on hold. And imagine, you know, for me having things put on hold for 10 years. That's a lot. My children are young, you know, and so it's hard and it's a crisis that people are calling out. It's both. It's whatever you need today. And so my clients are, and again, my clients are all across the world because if you are in Charlotte, that's where you live, we're on the phone having a session. Well, if you got to go to Dubai for a week, You're not going to lose your session. We're still going to call on the phone because it's still a telephone communication. So
you have a worldwide office.
Exactly. You have a worldwide office, and it's going to be communication. I'm still going to be able to meet you at the time that you need, and if that changes, I can still meet you. You're not going to lose me because you're out of the country, where you might be even more stressed out.
Right.
You're still going to be able to have me available to you to help with the sessions and move forward.
One of the other things earlier you were talking about, the way you do it online gives you, or by telepresence, gives you this tool that you can use for people that they don't feel the pressure of one-on-one, like writing. One thing I think that's really neat, especially for me, I'm very shy. So that
would
be a little bit of, you know, anonymity, a little bit of a protection, so I could tell you stuff, but I'm not right there going.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's pretty neat.
And, you know, I have purposely, so my 88 Moments of Coaching, I have a Facebook page. You can go there. You know, it's spelled out, 88 Moments of Coaching. But on my Facebook page, on anything that I put up, you will never see my picture. So I don't want you to create or have to see me and have a different opinion. So however you've created me in your mind, that's the person I am.
An avatar.
I am that person. And I am there for you in the form that you want to see me in. So that's how we are. So I don't see you and you're not seeing me. And we are there. We're together because we're going to work together in a cooperative relationship and help propel you forward. And that's going to be in life. That's going to be in corporate. I'm from corporate America, banking specifically. But I.
Oh, what are them?
Oh, my goodness.
I thought I heard of them.
That was my former life. And
former life.
I do. Real estate as well, so I'm familiar with that.
You know you'd never leave that life.
Well, that's true. That's true. But, you know, so, yes, it's just something that I think is helpful to many because, and then, you know, we work on a plan and we go in a monthly retainer and we go forward and, you know, we try to make things better.
Well, I want to thank you for dropping in and bringing the anonymous one sitting in the corner here who is going to be going to Winthrop.
Or NYU. Yes, decided.
Well, I really appreciate the 88 moments of enlightenment that you got.
Yes, and you can tell her, yes, she's supposed to.
Okay.
She was supposed to, anyway. Anyway, So we have another guest that's coming in here in a few minutes, but for the last couple of minutes here. So you don't want to say a few words? You start your practice, setting up your practice for people when you're a psychologist. You start doing it now.
What do you want to do?
I mean, because people are they'll be crazy in a few years when you're ready too. You know, they'll still be there crazy.
They'll be challenged.
Oh,
they won't be crazy.
You can say challenge. I'll say crazy. I mean, you know, challenge is crazy.
But, you know, in this world right now, psychology works in corporate America.
You think?
I mean, yes. I mean, they're hiring psychologists now for corporate America because we need to get a grip on what's going on with our people.
I did a media literacy course. I taught that here at John C. Smith University, Norfolk School of the Arts. I did one for AT&T in Washington, where they asked me to come in because they say, you know, a lot of our people, we have the seminars and 5 minutes, they're walking in the hallway, and you hear them talk about, oh, what did that guy just say? Remember he said, these are not the people in the mirror. These are the VPs. They have no idea. They sat there and they look, you know, you can always tell when someone knows what you're talking about. Of course, they're leaning forward, they're looking around, they understand. When people start looking around and looking at their watch and
that's like my 15-year-old in marketing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what's going on here? And then you hear them in the cafeteria line. You know, I missed that thing. Did you write down anything? Can I copy it? Or what, are you kidding me? I mean, these people getting paid $100,000. So we need to have you come in and try to get some literacy. See, literacy is just being able to read. It's also being able to understand what the person is saying. Comprehension. So I said, can't be done in one seminar. I mean, if they're 42 years old, it took them 42 years to get like that.
If I had those
Do we have 42 years?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
So So, you know, it is something that that can be done. And is that Father Carl? He's ready. Anyway, so what we're glad to have you all here, and you need to set up long-range goals there. And, you know, Simpsonville won't always be 5 or 6 people, and your father knows all of them.
We're a little
okay. There's, you know, that's like when I was in, I used to say when I was in Victorville, California, when we first went in the military, that's in, like, it was right, there's 189 miles from Los Angeles and 100 miles from Vegas or vice versa, and it had a population of 15, and 7 were dogs. It was all desert, high desert.
I think I need to exit stage left.
So, anyway, so we were, but now Simpsonville, does it have a zoo yet?
Well, Greenville has a zoo.
No, Simpsonville. Does Simpsonville have a zoo? When it gets a zoo, then you say, we are now a huge city.
Our Greenville Zoo, our giraffe is pregnant. How?
Our giraffe? You own a giraffe?
No.
Oh, I say your giraffe. Your
we
backyard?
People.
Oh,
people.
Okay.
How tall was the baby? She said 6 foot, 6'5", and 150 pounds about. So the size of
not a dog that big.
The size of my 15-year-old is dropping out of our giraffe, and we're on watch for it.
Oh my gracious Lord!
South Carolina. That's Pacific, not Greenville, North Carolina.
That's right. That's right. Because.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I came down here playing. I was used to play semi-pro baseball, and I was in Greenville. I never remember it was South Carolina, North Carolina. And to this day, I don't know if I was in North Carolina or South Carolina. I know it was Greenville.
Yeah.
And while I was sleeping, they were doing moonshine on the basement floor when I was up on the second floor sleeping. I said,
okay, well, that was Greenville, North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
That was not Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay.
I'm saving my people.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you guys leaving, or are you waiting to go out to have some meat? Because, I'm treating.
We're going out to Sharon Memorial Park and do my mother's flowers.
Oh.
For the fall. They have
right.
time on them.
Right.
So we're going to do the fall flowers.
And then what?
And then head home.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, because I'll be finished at 6.
I think we'll be.
Going home. Okay.
Yeah.
Is your father on the road?
He should be on the road.
Because I called him, but he didn't answer.
Yeah, I called too.
Okay. All right.
Maybe he doesn't like us. I don't know.
Possibly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Miss Angela, say hello to your brother.
Absolutely.
And the giraffe. And the giraffe. Okay. I also want to be reminded by my coach, my home coach, that I have to mention that there is someone else that I need to talk about, and that is Black Diamond Professional Cleaning Services.
Oh.
We need, this is a
give
a yeah.
shout out to everybody that we know.
Yeah,
this just random business.
Well, this is this is my life coach, she told me. And 704-771-3296. So if anybody needs cleaning services of any type, give them a call. They are professional cleaners that will do a great job. Black Diamond Professional Cleaning Services. Now, before our next guest arrives, now, see, this always happens to us.
Of course.
This always happens. We don't get into the to the actual, but we are back in our realm now.
Mm-hmm.
And before
we get back into our realm,
yes,
we're going to end up with another guest.
That's right. So, we need to see if he's ready to come in. But I want to thank Valerie for coming in. And
what she does with that scholarship.
That's right. Oh, yeah, that scholarship is my first cousin, Valerie, was Valerie. Her mother, Marilyn, was the director of nursing at Billingsley, it was a mental health facility here in Charlotte. And she's the one that got me to come down. And you can sit right here. Sit right there. Yeah, you can sit over here. Anyway, we have another guest. Well, actually, we are the guests. Yeah, you sit right there. No, don't worry. You sit right there. And we are the guests. And we are here at Our Lady of Consolation Catholic Church, which is my church here in Charlotte, North Carolina, 2301 Statesville Avenue. And specifically, we have with us Reverend Carl Del. How do you say the last name?
Del Judas.
Del Judas. Del Judas. And he just became the pastor at Our Lady of Consolation. Well, not yesterday, but a few months ago, was installed as the pastor at Our Lady of Consolation. And Father Carl. Father Carl is originally from Tenafly, New Jersey, and his family moved out to Los Angeles, California in 1949 and returned to Jersey, back to Jersey in 54. There were four people who grew up in the family. Both parents are now deceased, and he has a younger brother. All those younger brothers. Oh, gosh. My younger brother was named Dennis, and my father always told us that the one thing he doesn't like is a liar. He said, "Don't lie to me. I don't care if you rob, cheat. Don't lie to me." And I lied one time. I got a beat. I never got another beat. My brother. Please. My father would come from work and look at his watch. He said, "What time is it?" "Oh, it's time for Dennis to get a beating." Because I know he lied about something today. So Dennis the Menace, he was a menace. But Father Carl attended Appalachian State University and graduated in 73 with a BA in geography. Can you believe geography? I mean, that was a Regents course test we had to take in New York State to graduate from high school. Geography. I mean, you know, they did a survey, I think it was in New York, where they had, they asked people where they were located on a map. People did not know on a geographical map where they were located.
It is very sad that they don't stress geography these days. Now, I grew up in an age, my grandparents had National Geographic. So I grew up, you know, playing with those fantastic maps my entire life. But even when I went to school, I was getting a degree in history, took a geography as one of my electives, and I was one of the only people in class that knew geography. And ended up, the teacher had me become an assistant and help people because they couldn't even do basic things. Like, this is college level now. You had people who didn't know oceans, couldn't find, you know, major rivers on continents, and some people didn't even know the continents. I was floored.
Everything's flat. There is no continent. Anyway, we have, as I said, we have Father Carl here, and he also, it was a BA in Geography and Urban and Regional Planning.
That's right.
And received a MA in Urban Geography and Transportation Planning. Oh, so realistically, this is something that every major city needs. And I want to just say thank you for coming, Father Carl.
My pleasure, Michael.
And this is your second trip here?
This is my second time here at Our Lady Consolation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was served here from 1980 until spring of 1981 as a transitional deacon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was first ordained a priest in May of 1981. And then I was right after my ordination, I was assigned to Asheville in the mountains of St. Eugene Church.
Uh-huh.
So after 31 years, they decided to bring me back.
Is this normal for deacons to go to become priests? I mean, does it happen a lot, or is this infrequent?
One of the stages or steps in ordination for priesthood, when man is in seminary or praying for priesthood,
right,
he is received into the order of meter or acolyte, meter or lector, and then he is installed as an acolyte to serve at the altar.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if he's going on any further, the candidate is ordained a deacon. our case, transitional deacon, as opposed to the permanent diaconate, which we have in many of our parishes.
Right.
Deacons. Mm-hmm. And then after transitional diaconate.
Oh, so that's the difference then?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
Now these, so, and then from there, ordination to priesthood.
So you can go in with the idea of becoming a deacon and not becoming a priest.
It's possible to do that.
Yes.
Like we have two deacons here in the parish.
Right, 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 right.
Right. Deacons serve as deacons, right.
Mm-hmm.
Deacons
mm-hmm.
for life.
Deacons for life. Well, and one of the reasons why I wanted to have you talk today was the other, maybe it was about a month ago, you, because I go to church on Saturday, I love the relaxed atmosphere. There's no hustle and bustle. I just love the Saturday Mass. And you had mentioned in your sermon, which I thought was one of the most, I don't know how I could put it, best sermons, I guess I could say, I have heard in connection with how we treat other people.
Yes.
And I think I told you that. And I just, it hit me so hard because the reality of it was so profound. And could you just, and it had to do with your grandparents, your grandmother.
That's correct, my maternal mm-hmm. grandmother, mm-hmm. yes. The readings of that particular weekend, that particular Sunday and mm-hmm. Saturday night, reflected very much on neighborliness, care of neighbor, and people of faith, mm-hmm. live one's faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to talk about how we live faith,
mm-hmm.
claim all kinds of statements about faith or religion,
mm-hmm.
but people of faith are called to live the faith every day.
Right.
Live the faith.
Walk the walk.
Walk the walk. That's right, Michael. Right. Walk the walk. The story goes back. I heard this growing up as a child. Back in 1942, mm-hmm. after President Roosevelt signed executive order, I believe it was 1066 or one of the, whatever it was, I forget the number right now, allowing for zones of exclusion on the areas of the United States bordered by the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
That from those particular areas, for 100 miles inland, if I recall, people could be excluded for whatever reasons would be necessary for national security.
You mean excluded? What do you mean actually?
People could be removed.
Removed.
Right. Zones mm-hmm. of exclusion. And on the West Coast, in California particularly.
And this is the United States of America now.
Right, right.
Where we're having exclusion zones.
Exclusion zones. National security during the war. There was the rounding up. And sending to the rounding up of Japanese Americans, whether they were just recent arrivals or were of Japanese lineage.
Mm-hmm.
They were rounded up, and they were taken to further, they moved to the east, and they were put into detention centers.
Mm.
We call them detention centers. But if you look at history, when the enemy does it, we call them concentration camps.
So yeah.
It depends on who writes the history.
Who writes the history, right.
So these people were taken from their homes. They were allowed to take only what they could carry in some suitcases, I believe, and put it on buses and move to the various areas inland, maybe to the high desert, even to Nevada. I don't know all the locations
mm-hmm.
where these detention centers were. Well, where my grandmother lived in California at the time, in Gardena, California, her next-door neighbors, her immediate neighbors on one side, were all Japanese-American families.
Mm-hmm.
And the children of those families went to school with my mother and her sister and her brothers. So the families interact as far as the children were concerned, and it was a neighborly acquaintance between the families.
Mm-hmm.
However, so right in 1942, when the army came, I'm saying corrected on that, they came to take the families and move them west. They boarded the house, left them, put a do not cross sign, do not enter.
So they took these people who owned these houses.
That's correct.
The Japanese.
Right.
And took them out of their houses.
That's right.
And they could only carry a suitcase.
Something like that.
Or something like that.
Yeah, right.
Right. And did they tell them beforehand we were coming to get you, or they just showed up one day?
No, it was published. People knew this was going to happen. This was published. This was published. So both families, I remember the names Kobayashi and Ono.
Mm-hmm.
They were two families. They were both professional families. Both families were dentists.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, later on, when I went to my first dentist as a child growing up, it was to Dr. Ono's office.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after the families were taken and put on the buses and sent to the East, my grandmother, farm girl from Iowa, she knew no good was going to come from this.
Mm.
So she broke into the houses.
Mm.
Well, it's called breaking and entering is what it is. And it wasn't just a state law. It was not a federal law.
Right.
To another house, and with her children, they removed items in the house that they knew were of a deep intrinsic value to the families.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what they were? I remember being told all the items. It may have been family photos, china, porcelain,
mm-hmm.
things of such a nature you just can't replace.
Right.
And the, some of the items were quite old, I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you go back a couple of centuries with these items. So they took these items, went to my grandmother's house, and she buried them under her house.
No, I guess she had been in those houses before, so she saw these items there, and she knew about these things that they were there.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So she buried them under the house, and they stayed there for the course of the war.
The entire war.
The entire war buried under the house. And then when the families returned, the Kobayashis and Onos returned to their homes, there was nothing left. The houses were there.
Because the people who came in just looted them.
There were looters that came in. Looters came in, and everything was removed from the house, from the kitchen fixtures, bathroom fixtures, everything, furniture. Nothing was left but the four walls of the house.
Mm.
Even the doors were taken from the hinges, and the hinges were gone, too.
Oh, God.
Don't forget, it was the war. Couldn't
right.
get metal.
Right.
I'm not trying to rationalize.
Right.
Nothing, so they were taken. So the families came back to start all over again. And then when they returned to the neighborhood, my grandmother and my aunts and uncles went under the house, and they brought out all these items.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave them to the Onos and Kobayashis that they could start all over again. Mm-hmm. Have something of value, kind of a reminding of who they are, who their roots, and just
right.
family
right.
stuff they did.
Yeah, the stuff, because most of that stuff, I guess, was passed down, maybe could have been centuries.
It was some items were very old.
Right.
I don't remember seeing them as a child. I would remember that.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told that the items, many of them go back quite a few centuries in the family.
So I guess the Kobayashis, I think it was in it.
Kobayashi.
Yeah, they, I'm sure they were really grateful and thankful.
I think they were.
Mm-hmm.
I was supposed that they would be
right.
for that, yeah.
Well, so the main thrust of this was the text from the sermon that you connected with this about how we need to be more neighborly and how we don't know our neighbors now. I remember going when I was going to school, and I went to St. Matthew's, which was like, see, one block up and then two blocks down. So it was about 3.5 blocks from my house.
Right.
But and if I walked on another block to come down, even that block, the people knew me. Every single person that came, because I would get out the same time every day, and I'd walk down that same block every day.
Right.
And when they would look at you, and they said, well, if you do that, I'm going to tell your father and your mother. They told your father and your mother.
Usually before we got home that happened.
Before.
The phone rang and they knew. The parents knew already.
It was over. It was over. Now, my parents were working, so they weren't home yet. But my grandfather, who was a major in the Army, retired. He was there because we lived in a three-family house. So there was no place I could turn to. And, of course, my brother Dennis. It was 2 o'clock, so it was time for his meeting. But anyway, the thing was, today we don't have that anymore. Because people don't seem to be or want to help their neighbor. And one of the things that I remember about growing up, and one of the things that, you know, a lot of these things that especially, and that is, I don't want to make it political, but a lot of what these right-wing talksters talk about, I don't remember ever being discussed in Catholic school. I mean, it was always about your neighbor. What you'll do for them, you'll do for yourself. But if you can't help your neighbor like you help yourself,
mm-hmm.
I mean, where are we at?
I was just going to say, Mike, not to deflect your question or to defend people, but today's society, if there is a defense, has changed slightly. You have a much more mobile society, far more than used to. So in the defense of the way communities work today, everybody seems to be from somewhere else, and they move much more than they used to. So your neighbors often switch more often. So in defense of people, sometimes you don't know your neighbors the way you used to, because used to no one ever moved away. You knew every family. You knew everybody's relationship. And that may be part of the problem.
Well, you know, and I think you're very correct with that. But when you have single-family homes, like on my block, there's 1, 2, 3. There might be 8 houses on one block because I live down at the end of the cul-de-sac. And so there's maybe about 7 houses on the other side. I've only ever been in – I've been in maybe – 4 houses. And I've been living there. My mom was the 3rd house built on the block in 1986. So I was now, I ran out my house for 7 years because my transfer got canceled. I couldn't come down here for 7 years, but I was there before all these other people were there. Most of them, except one person up at the corner is an Asian family. They were the first people on the block. And then across the street from him was the show house. And then my house was built. So when I came down there, like my next neighbor on one side of me and both sides of me, I know them quite well. But the other people I don't know. I mean, I see them a wave. That is it. And when I grew up on my block, they were all attached houses, but, you know, most of them were 3-family houses. I knew everybody on the block, every single person on the block. So, and my parents knew, I knew them because if they had kids, I knew them. Okay, so most of the people had kids on the block. And my parents knew most of the people on the block. But you don't have that today. So I don't – I understand mobility makes people move around quicker. But it and it just wasn't that we didn't go to the same churches, because both, I think, half the people living on the block, it was an Italian Irish neighborhood, went to St. Matthew's or St. Gregory's 4 blocks away. So – but the other people didn't. So I can say, yes, you're correct, Thomas, in saying about the migration, the mobility. Everybody's got cars now, especially down here where there's no public transportation to speak of. That doesn't prevent you from being neighborly. What do you think, Father Paul?
Let's see what Thomas said, you know, about people, rootlessness of today's trip.
Right.
People do. I was recently buying an appliance for the house, and there's a story behind this one. And I said to the Sears, and so the salesperson said, "Can I help you?" So I said, "Yeah, I'd like to get a new dishwasher, because the old one that just died. It was over 35 years old." And so I said to the sales clerk, "I'd like to get a new dishwasher, and it'll last at least 30 years." And she said, "Not in your life." Had a friend with me who said, "Why buy a dishwasher that will outlive you, Carl?" And I said, "Yeah, you got a point." And I find out that it is not uncommon that because of popular trends and tastes, people sometimes change their kitchens because they're outdated. Whatever that means, I have no idea. I've seen on television shows beautiful kitchens with all the bells and whistles.
Right.
It's outdated. Give me that kitchen. I love it. I've got everything I need or want.
That's right. That's right.
That's why exactly the changes. People's tastes change. People change the decor, whatever, as the whim meets them. And so there's this sense of temporariness, being temporary. And as explained to me by a builder, I talked to him about this. He said that turnover in houses is tremendous. Mm-hmm. People move in, they stay a few years, they're transferred, they go someplace else. That's part of the game plan today.
Mm-hmm.
So houses turn over.
Well, but you see, now getting to the point of being neighborly and
right.
and having to have the ability to feel that, you were up in Brevard for 21 years. I mean, do you feel that it has changed that much, the way people feel towards other people? Especially now, I mean, love thy neighbor as yourself.
Right. You know, I can't put a nail, if I could put a nail on it, get it hard, I'd write a book, I'd be rich, I could be tired here. But people want to be appreciated. There's an innate need to be appreciated, wanted, desired, held, be identified, respected, dignity of the person, to be appreciated, to see as another human being. And we all have that urge, this drive within us.
Mm-hmm.
It's right there. But sometimes it's very difficult when someone is not going to be in a place long enough to really begin to establish some kinds of roots. We can have temporary relationship with people, which is good to do so. But sometimes, unless we feel we know the person or the people well enough, that maybe responding to a need or a perceived need may seem like an intrusion in their life.
Mm.
It may not be. We're afraid of being rejected because we're extending a hand of friendship. Maybe we feel that maybe we'd be intruding on them. Some of maybe that possibly there. But neighborliness, regardless, you know, I'm walking through the supermarket. You know, if I come up to the supermarket and I have my shopping cart, and I've seen this happen, I've done it myself, and I have coming up exactly the same time is a woman, a mother, with three children in tow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my need is to get home and get dinner on the table.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see by looking, her need is more important than my need.
Mm.
She's got a family to feed.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually say, okay, go on over. You take it in. You got to go ahead. You got kids to feed.
Right,
I don't. Yes, Thomas.
Yeah, well,
that's neighborliness. Recognizing the situation that I have a need, but maybe there's a greater need out there. Like that, for example, that mother with three children.
Mm-hmm.
My need takes second place.
Well, but compassion also. But and the great quote about rich man going through the eye of the needle. A camel as hard as a camel would go through the eye of a needle.
That's right.
As rich man getting the kingdom of heaven. We have, and I think this started in the early 80s. We have this. Me first. This has been perpetuated and drummed into us. We can't have that feeling and have the love for our neighbor. They're both
yes.
diametrically opposed to one another. So how can something like this be even look forward to as trying to get changed? I mean, doesn't this have to come down to our children, the next generation? Because this generation, forget it, you ain't in danger.
I mean, it's forget it. It's lost. Mm-hmm. The only generation where we can start changing that is the next generation. But if you don't have, if the people who feel that way are training the next generation, how's it going to change? How can we get over this hump that, you know, your neighbor needs help? And it doesn't have to be monetary. It doesn't have to, it can be physical. It can be helping them across the street. It could be helping the woman with the three kids go ahead of you in line in the supermarket.
Yeah. Let me tell you a story about that. Right after I was ordained, back in the early 80s, three of my aunts,
mm-hmm.
my father's sisters, moved in together. They were all in their 80s and going into their mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
And my one aunt lived in that same house since 1930. This is over 50 years in the same location. And she knew the neighborhood, and about six families really remained in that block
mm-hmm.
for over almost 50 years. They've mm-hmm. stayed there. And the house next door always had a good turnover of people who stayed a number of years and then moved on elsewhere. And one particular neighbor moved in. It was a Chinese family from Hong Kong. They got out of Hong Kong long before Hong Kong went to the Red Chinese.
Right.
And they knew. They got out.
Mm-hmm.
So they moved in and were a delightful family. And the neighborliness was there.
Mm-hmm.
And as it happened, this one particular autumn day, my aunt looks out, and the leaves in her lawn were raked up. And this wasn't a huge piece of property. And one of the children from next door raked up her leaves and piled them in the curb for the sanitation people to pick up. And she thanked them, the family, and looked out another day, and the leaves were raked up in the backyard.
Mm.
One day, there was a snowstorm. Of course, it's winter now, and the snow was shoveled from the walkway of the driveway. And the neighbors came over, young children, of course. They were middle school age, getting on into high school. And the family had the children come over and take care of the three elderly ladies next door. And one particular day, after a few years of living there, the father came over and apologized profusely to my three aunts. And they're wondering, why is he apologizing? My aunt told me this story. He came over to apologize because his children, already now in high school, he asked them to go over and maybe pick up the leaves or move something around. And they said, no, we don't want to do that. And they said something profound, which made me get a chill in my back. You're not going to help them because the children now. That's to helping the neighbors next door, that's not the American way.
Hmm.
It was unbelievable. 1980, what they observed coming from Hong Kong, Chinese culture, forget the British word, Chinese culture goes back 5,000 years, and there were little children helping out, then getting on and beginning to think abstractly, growing up, helping.
Indoctrinated.
Them, indoctrinated, it's not the American way. And I figured what they were learning already, but they were picking up. It wasn't probably being said. It's what was not being done or being done. And I said, oh, my gosh, what an indictment against us.
Oh, you know, and it's just like there's this great TV series on HBO called Newsroom. And one of the profound things the star of the show says, we're not number one in the world. We're, 47th in child mortality rate. We're 24th in literacy. He said, we're not number one anymore. So we have, and, you know, for the life of me, we played the clip, and I know you couldn't hear it, Father Carl. We played this clip, and I have to go back to, and I didn't want to be political, but we have to go back to the conference call that Mitt Romney had with all the CEOs, telling them that they need to tell their workers, if they don't vote for me, they're going to lose their jobs. Now, this is – it's an indictment against – now, I don't want to say it's an indictment against the American way, but it's an indictment against those that have corrupted the American way.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, we've talked about this many, many times before, but there is a culture, a certain culture, that has arisen in this country. And we often joke about the greed is good line from the movie.
Right.
But it's indicative of that culture. There's a certain culture that is all about me. It's all about getting ahead at any cost. And the only end is how much money and toys do you have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about that. It's become pervasive, so much so that a certain party, a certain faction of a certain party, actually had their two books that they read in the last 10 years. You remember them both.
Mm-hmm.
They were The Prince,
mm-hmm.
right, and Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
They were their two must reads.
Mm-hmm.
And they said to read them over and over every year, and let's study these, you know, Machiavellian principles. And Ayn Rand's principle was literally that there was one holy word,
mm-hmm.
and the holy word was I,
mm-hmm.
and that was all that mattered.
Right.
And it has become pervasive, and I think it is corrupting. But we've gotten to the point where now it's all about I, or the me, and what can I get.
Mm-hmm.
And just literally run over your neighbor, and run over everyone else, and fire your workers, whatever it takes, but it's all about me. And what can I? How can I profit today?
Right.
And that's going to destroy American culture. And you're right, it's an indictment.
And you know, when you were telling that story, I remember growing up, my mother and father, or my grandfather, the major, and you know, he is the major. When he became, matter of fact, the grandkids had to call him major, but my grandmother had to call him major. My mother had to call, all his children, everybody had to call him the major because he was the major. So the thing is that he lived on the first floor, and my mother and us, we lived on the second and third floor. And he said, I go, Dennis, that's my brother, shovel the sidewalk, snow. Shovel the sidewalk. And he said, go on, keep going, do the next yard. We had to shovel. Go on, do the next one. I said, why are we going? He said, because I might trip if I'm walking down the street to the car. He said, I thought I was doing it for the people coming. Yeah, well, I'm going to trip. If I trip, they'll trip. He said, now go up this way. So we had to go down to the left side. Now, three doors down. So, I never got the reason. I mean, I got the reason because he told me to do it. I had to do it. But realistically thinking about it, the people who lived on either side. Now, the one directly left side of me, they were young enough to do it. There was Italian family, Del Piero's. Five were policemen. One was a bus driver. One was a baseball player, pitched for the Dodgers. They could have done it. But we did it anyway. They weren't home. So, especially if they weren't home, you had to do it. So, and the same thing with sweeping the sidewalk. And it's three doors down on either side. You know, so that was being neighborly. And the Ayn Rand philosophy of I is what really is exactly what you were saying, Father Carl, about a dynasty of people that has come out of China. I mean, thousands and thousands of years before us, 1,000 years at least. They, 100 years, maybe 1,000 years, but they always grew up in this mentality that you had to help your neighbor. And now they lost that. The father had to be absolutely, I don't know what he was thinking. I mean, what could he have thought of that? I mean, what could he have thought of that? In closing here, what is something that we can try to focus on how much it means in our life and spiritual life about why we need to be neighborly? What can we, right, is there anything that you can say to us about what it means to be neighborly?
Put me on the spot, Michael.
Well, I Well, you know, realistically.
If I find something to jump into the middle and say, looking someone else's need
mm-hmm.
for my own,
mm-hmm.
whoever we are, what is another person's need? What is their need? What is my need? That other people are important, no matter who they may be, to respect the dignity of another person as a human being, no matter who they are or where they're from, what language, what color, what religion or non-religion, to respect other people. And everybody, regardless of person's own belief, I believe, I was taught, we're all created by God in God's image.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all God's children. And when we begin to realize that we are all, people of faith realize we're all God's children,
mm-hmm.
then we're challenged to really live our faith. See what we can do to be neighbors, to live in community, we call community, to really help be attuned and respond to those around us. I know that when we talk about the message of we'll say Christ himself,
mm-hmm.
He's always taking care of other people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He's always took, whether it was the healing, whether we fed 5,000, whether he was on the lake shore talking.
Do we ever, not cut you up, but do we ever know, do we ever hear about
what?
Christ growing up and washing the dishes or sweeping the floor? We don't hear about that. We hear about him going out of his way to help his neighbor. Now, we have to assume that he was in there washing dishes and sweeping the floor in his own house also. So, you know, the thing is that, so he did, the other thing was to help your neighbor. And it's just like you mentioned when we talked before about this is really the parallel, I think, is would be the mosque in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
That some people did not want to be built. I mean, after 9/11. About two miles or more from the actual site, which was going to be a cultural center everybody, but some people, I don't know if it was politically motivated or not, just couldn't cross that line of seeing anybody else or were using the excuse not to cross the line for their own benefit. And the thing that if you have to use an excuse and not the actual how you actually feel to state your case, you don't really have a case. Divide and conquer. Right. Well, in closing, anything for us, Father Koff?
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a little scripture to you.
Sure, absolutely.
To your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
After
the Lord knows we really need it.
Well, I don't know anybody else. I need it. All right. This is from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 25.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said to those on the left, depart from me, you accursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. A stranger, and you gave me no welcome. Naked, and you gave me no clothing. Ill and in prison, and you did not care for me. Then they will answer and say, Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or stranger, or naked, or ill, or in prison, and not minister to your needs? He will answer them, Amen, I say to you, what you did not do for one of these least ones, you did not do for me. Word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. That is absolutely true. I want to thank you for being here with us. Well, no, us being with you.
It's an honor having you both.
both you gentlemen here. No strangers come back again.
And well, let's see how much if the president gets back in, if he can change any minds to get things going more in the direction of helping people with health care and keeping us out of another war. But there are so many people on both sides of the aisle that want to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
It is only a handful of people that are blocking the drain and clogging the wheel. There's only a handful of those people. And we just have to realize that that's the reason why the wheel is clogged. It's not that the left and the right. It's just this small group of people that are the Ayn Rand disciples, as we can say. So, once again, thank you for the call, and we will be back with you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Right now, I just want to play a short something for everyone.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, what I'm talking about, what this, the gentleman you just heard, was the father, excuse me, of the conservative movement. And you heard what he says. Their policy is not to have more people to vote. The less people that vote, the better off they are. And we are talking about the Progressive Party, ladies and gentlemen. We're not talking about Joe's barbecue joint and how many drinks are going to be going around in a bar. We're talking about the conservative ultra-right wing of the party. They do not want you to vote. And when you don't vote, you give them the authority to do whatever they want to do. Now, I was talking to Thomas, and Thomas brought up a good subject when we were talking on the car about some of the rights that we have, and which president gave it to us.
Oh, yes. Well, there's actually an article. I believe it was in either New York Times or
that communist newspaper?
Something, yeah. Oh. I was reading just 2 days ago. Anyway, really interesting little article, but it pointed out, it was making a joke. It was you know, talking about the perceptions of things. And it started out saying, once upon a time, there was a president who, you know, pushed for national health care reform. There was one who pushed to have a law that all employers had to give insurance, pay for insurance for their employees.
Pay for insurance. Yeah.
You know, that would be a way to take care of your workers. Mm-hmm. And then it said for the ones who are unemployed in America, it was the role of the federal government to provide health care insurance. And then for the people who had money or had worked or were self-sufficient, there should be a federal law and protections out there to regulate the insurance market to make sure that they got quality services at the lowest possible cost, that type of thing. And then it went on to mention other things they wanted to do in this fantasy land.
Mm-hmm.
Things like push for reform of worker safety, of the amount of hours you could work, push for a minimum wage for all workers.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that. Well, you know, build a safety net nationwide. And it talked about all the things that they was able to accomplish. But then it said, well, luckily, he didn't accomplish a lot of the goals in health care and other things because he was stopped in the second term as he was.
Oh, my gosh. Why?
And didn't get to finish the job.
And they said, ironic thing about the story was, it's not Obama. This is President Nixon. And Richard Nixon was stopped by the impeachment threat and had to leave office. Now, the point of it was, he said, look how far the Republican Party's moved. Look how right they have shifted. When their own president was the leading champion of, you know, OSHA work safety rules, mandatory minimum wage, health care for workers, insurance protections, you know, things like that. When did this become evil, you know?
Unbelievable. Well, it's because that they saw how much money they made in the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president, and they paid a 39% tax rate. It reminds me of the scene from The Godfather with Michael Corleone and what's his name? Oh, I can't remember his name. He says, Michael, we made, your father and I made money for everybody. We were bigger than U.S. Steel. Everybody made money.
Right.
But you know, these people just don't want to make money. They want to be the only one,
right,
that make money.
Well, you know, it's the old cliche about I want a ladder up and I want help, and then when I get up there and get through the door, I'm going to pull the ladder up and slam it in your face.
That's,
you know,
right.
Only I can get in.
And to think of the person before, Hyman Roth and
Hyman
Michael
Roth.
Corleone.
Yep.
And this we were bigger than U.S. Steel, but greed has gotten so perverse because of the Enron and all you Enron people out there. Let me tell you, Enron, who preached for everybody being for themselves, and the greedy people. She took, changed her name, not changed name, went back to her Russian
name,
her actual name, and was on Social Security for the remainder of her life. So she is one of the 47% that Mr. Romney, was talking about. She was one of the 47% that Mr. Romney was talking about. And the problem here is that we need to understand that, and I'm looking for it right here. Let me just play a little bit of this right here. And the president brought it up. He brought it up because the mister brought it up. He went through that door, but he didn't turn on the light. And when he didn't turn on the light, the president said,
I believe Governor Romney is a good man. Loves his family, cares about his faith. But I also believe that when he said behind closed doors that 47% of the country considered themselves victims who refused personal responsibility, think about who he was talking about. Folks on Social Security who've worked all their lives. Veterans who sacrificed for this country. Students who are out there trying to hopefully advance their own dreams, but also this country's dreams. Soldiers who are overseas fighting for us right now. People who are working hard every day, paying payroll tax, gas taxes, but don't make enough income. And I want to fight for them. That's what I've been doing for the last 4 years, because if they succeed, I believe the country succeeds.
The country succeeds.
The country succeeds.
Because you know what? People forget. The big I, the big me, didn't build the whole country.
Oh, we didn't build it?
You know.
They built it. Who's we? Who built it anyway?
The we.
The we built it.
Exactly.
And
we either succeed or we fail. You know, it takes, you know, that village, remember that little?
Takes a village.
Right. We're all in this together, and it takes all of us working together to get somewhere.
Well,
I mean, one of my personal pet peeves about this whole anti-tax movement right now and everything is, what fantasy land do they live in? Where do they think that things magically come from? I mean, where does infrastructure come from? Where do your roads, your sewer, your power lines, all this stuff come from? It's like they believe it just falls from the sky.
Well, and as best
pay for our country.
Well, it's yeah, but see, you pay for it either in the sweat and tears of building the roads, or you pay for it by defending your country. And I wanted to play you a little something here about speaking about the Romney men defending the country. Let me just play you a little bit.
In tonight's rewrite, another episode of Romney Men, that lovable clan of Republican warmongers who never met a war they didn't like, but never dreamed of serving in the military themselves. Willard Romney's fear of participating in war is so extreme, and his definition of war so broad, that he is even afraid of going on The View.
But the view is fine, although the view is high risk because of the five women on it, only one is conservative, and four are sharp-tongued and not conservative, Whoopi Goldberg in particular.
Mitt Romney chicken-hawked out of going on The View today and sent his wife in his place, and thanks to Whoopi Goldberg, the legend of Romney men came up.
As First Lady, if you get the job, it's going to entail a lot of things, and one of those things is going to be talking to the mothers whose children are coming home in bags, you know, from wars. Now, I believe that your religion doesn't allow you to go fight.
No, that's not correct.
Okay, so
we have many, many members of our faith that are serving in armed services.
Okay.
And the funny part of that is what exactly? What does Ann Romney find funny about serving in the armed services? Nothing. That's what she and her husband do when they're very, very nervous in public, when they really don't like where the conversation is going. You get that nervous Romney laugh. Well, let's see where the conversation went.
Well, I say that because when I read about your husband, what I had read, and maybe you can correct this, is that the reason that he didn't serve in Vietnam was because it was against the religion. That's what I read.
No,
that's not
correct. He was serving his mission, and you know, my five sons have also served missions. None served in the military, but I do have one son that feels that he's giving back to his country in a significant way, where he is now a doctor and he is taking care of veterans. So, you know, we find different ways of serving, and my five boys and my husband did serve missions, did not serve in the military.
Okay, so they didn't serve in the military, but they did serve missions. What kind of missions? CIA missions? Ann Romney just used the phrase served missions three times without ever saying what the missions were. Why didn't she just say religious missions or Mormon missions, which is what they were? When Romney men reach military age, they bravely go out into the world and try to convert people to Mormonism. That's what Mitt Romney was doing when this picture was taken on a beach in France, while hundreds of thousands of young American men his age were being shot at in Vietnam. Mitt and Ann's five sons did not grow up in peacetime. Each of them reached military age during wartime, and each of them, like their father before them, refused to even consider serving in the wars of their era that they support. They've supported those wars. Not serving in wars, you don't support serving in wars if you're a Romney man, not serving in a war that you don't support, that's a perfectly honorable choice. Millions of Americans have made that choice. But during Vietnam, Mitt Romney's war, men were forced to serve through the draft, whether they supported the war or not, a draft that Mitt Romney did, in fact, evade by using a special draft deferment allowed only to Mormon men. Whoopi Goldberg was closer to the truth than Ann Romney acknowledged. Ann Romney is right that serving in the military is not against the Romney family religion, but the complete truth includes the fact that young Mormon men were allowed to use a special deferment that no one else was allowed to use. To avoid being killed in Vietnam and to avoid becoming one of the 58,000 Americans killed in Vietnam. But this is important. Not all Mormon men made Mitt Romney's choice. Not all of them hid behind the special deferment that they were offered. Some Mormon men did their missionary service for their church and served in Vietnam. Brave Mormon men were killed in Vietnam, men Mitt Romney's age, while Mitt Romney was sitting out the war in France. Serving in war is not against the Romney family religion, but it is against the Romney family tradition of safely and always pursuing self-interest. Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, did not serve in the war of his era, World War II. You might have heard of that one. And George Romney's father never considered joining the American military because he spent much of his early life in Mexico, where the Romney family was hiding out from the enforcement of American laws against polygamy. Mitt Romney's great-grandfather brought the family to Mexico, where he was able to keep his five wives. Needless to say, Miles Park Romney, who hated the laws of the United States so much that he fled the country, never considered joining the military of a country whose laws he found so personally oppressive. Since Romney men have no idea what the weight of military service actually feels like, Mitt Romney was able to actually say this the first time he ran for president when he was asked, "How many of your five sons are currently serving in the military?"
"One of the ways my sons are showing support for our nation is helping to get me elected because they think I'd be a great president."
The Romney men's refusal to serve in the military while championing every war that comes along and urging us into another one in Iran right now, that continues to intrigue inquiring reporters.
"All of you served your church going on missions. Did you ever consider serving your country by putting on a uniform, by serving in the military?"
"You know, I think we can look at the guys who served in the military, men and women, and just say that's the biggest sacrifice you can make for your country. It's nothing any of us did, but we look at those guys with a tremendous amount of respect."
"And Ben, do you regret you never served?
I look at my wife's family right now, and I'm in residency, and I spend a lot of my time at the VA hospital. I get to work with vets who have made great sacrifices for this country, and I look at their lives, and hopefully I get to serve them a little bit too."
Notice that Romney men did not dare answer the question that was asked. Did you ever consider serving your country by putting on a uniform? Do you regret not serving? They didn't answer that question, but I can answer it for them. And the Romney men answer is, "Are you kidding me? We're Romney men. We're afraid of serving in the military. Every one of us. We always have been, and that's even before we found out how much it pays." The flawlessly consistent intergenerational combat cowardice of Romney men makes today's threat of physical violence from a Romney man all the more surprising. Mitt Romney's oldest son, Taggart Romney, was the guest of honor on a North Carolina radio show yesterday.
"Okay, I'm going to ask something I know a lot of people want to know, or at least I do. What is it like for you to hear the President of the United States call your dad a liar? How do you react to that?"
"Well, jump out of your seat and you want to rush down the debate stage and take a swing at him. But you know you can't do that because, first, because there's a lot of Secret Service between you and him, but also because this is the nature of the process. That, you know, they're going to try to do everything they can do to try to make my dad into someone he's not. We signed up for it. We got to kind of sit there and take our punches and then send him right back the other way."
"Okay, Taggart, let's have a little talk, just you and me, you. When I hear you talk about taking a swing and taking punches, Why do I get the feeling that you've never actually taken a punch or thrown a punch? I didn't have that luxury in the part of Boston that I grew up in, but in your rich suburban Boston life, with your father filling a $100 million trust fund for you, I don't know. I just get the feeling that things were kind of different for you. Now, I know you've got a lot to be pissed off at these days, starting with the name Taggart, which you got every right to be wicked pissed off at for every day of the 42 years of your life. So let me try to help you deal with all this aggression you're feeling right now. You're mad at President Obama for calling your father a liar? Well, let's get something straight. He didn't call your father a liar. I did. The president just said that what your father said isn't true. I've been saying all year that your father is a liar. I've repeatedly said that your father lies and is trying to lie his way into the White House. So, you want to take a swing at someone for calling your old man a liar? Take a swing at me. Come on. Come on. And don't worry. There won't be any Secret Service involved. Just us. And I'll make it easy for you. I'll come to you. Anytime, anywhere. Go ahead, Taggart. Take your best shot.
Take your best shot. And that was the great Lawrence O'Donnell from MSNBC News. And I wanted to play the whole thing, so everybody could hear the gist of this. The Romney coward chicken hawks. Romney ducked Vietnam by running to France on a mission. He still could have done his mission and still perform his duty. And as I said about the other chicken hawk, Ryan, or better known as the Eddie Munster, he wants to complain, he wants to fight. Well, he needs to go down, take the oath to the nearest recruiter, put on your uniform, grab a rifle, and stand post. Otherwise, we don't care what you say, because you're a coward. Was it PBX or A&P or Walgreen thing that he takes, that PS90 or whatever, I don't know what the heck it is. It don't do you any good unless you're beating up women. Now, I don't know if you do that, because you're not beating up anybody I know.
What are you saying? Abs don't make a backbone?
No.
Oh.
No, they don't.
Hey, like, speaking of backbones, the Republicans seem to love this chicken hawk thing. I don't know what.
There's so many of them.
I mean, this last generation. Now, I have to
weak, say, hard, and carry a limp stick.
Oh, man. I mean, hey, are you talking about dick?
I wasn't, but since you're bringing it into question.
Hey, we're talking about the heavyweight champion.
Yes.
The five-time deferment king.
That's right. Right. Him and that other blowhard, Fat Rush Limbaugh, who had the nerve to say that Candy Crowley could never get a man because she's fat. But he can get women because has money.
Oh, yeah.
See, it all comes down.
And drugs.
He has the drugs, too. It all comes down to who has money. That's all they care about. Who has money? And the problem is, it was something else he said, Romney was talking about, when one of the people was questioning him about how is he going to help people who don't have the ability to pay for their insurance. How is he going to do this? And, you know, what deductions is he going to cut?
In terms of bringing down deductions, one way of doing that would be to say everybody gets, I'll pick a number, $25,000 of deductions and credits. And you can decide which ones to use.
Now, I thought they had a plan. I thought he had a 5-point plan. That was his end right there. If he couldn't figure out any place else to tell us about the 5-point plan that he has, then that was the time where he could have said, well, listen, my 5-point plan is right here. But what does he say? He says, oh, let's take a figure. If this is how a CEO runs a company, let's just take a figure?
Well, look, Mike, these are the guys. He's been backtracking for months because, if you remember, he originally had a massive plan. It was like 57 points or something. You remember when he rolled that thing out and it crashed into a wall and he said, oh, my God.
He put them all in folders. So he's got five folders, and the 57 are in those five folders.
So he got lambasted for that, and everybody was just going, oh, you cannot do that. It's too much for the electric. You got to have a pithy little scene. So he condensed it all to the 5-point plan.
Well,
now they won't even talk about the 5 points. They won't give any details.
And at the debate the other night, the president spoke about it. Let's hear what he said.
Governor Romney says he's got a 5-point plan. Governor Romney doesn't have a 5-point plan. He has a 1-point plan. And that plan is to make sure that folks at the top play by a different set of rules. Now, Governor Romney was a very successful investor. If somebody came to you, Governor, with a plan that said, here, I want to spend $7 or $8 trillion, and we're going to pay for it, but we can't tell you until maybe after the election how we're going to do it, you wouldn't have taken such a sketchy deal.
Would you? I mean, how do you become the CEO, the chief operating officer of a billion-dollar corporation, by taking anything that just comes, oh, let's just take a number and run with that?
Yeah, let's just take it on faith. Yeah. It'll be good. They're good for it. Trust us.
Trust me. You know, and that reminds me, trust me, I know better, because the problem is, the reason why I know better is because I am the one you need to trust. And back in 1945, but let's hear what another president said named FDR.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things, but we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
I mean, that was said almost 65, 68 years ago.
Yep.
Trust me. Trust me. Didn't Ronald Reagan say trust but verify? I mean, isn't that what he said, trust but verify? This man wants to go and tell us all these things that he is going to do different because he has done them. I have been in business for 25 years. The problem, they don't understand that the United States of America is not a business.
I remember, this is the guy who said that he wanted his cabinet to be modeled on a board.
That's right. Now, was he talking about a monopoly board? He must have been. He wants his cabinet looking just like a monopoly board, but he controls the board.
Right.
And it's your money, but he gets it.
Yeah, but what's scary about that is, of course, this is a guy who he loves boards so much, he claimed to still be on the board, still be the chief officer of all these companies when he was supposedly resigned from them and running the Olympics. Remember that?
Oh, yes. And by the by, about the Olympics.
And he's like, oh, they just accidentally left my name on the paperwork.
And by the by about the Olympics, he uses the Olympics as his expertise on how he saved the Olympics, he never puts into the mix that he also borrowed $300 million from usins, from us people in the country here, to balance the Olympics. He doesn't say, as the governor of one of the states in the United States of America, that's in their constitution, that the governor must balance the budget every year. That's why he balanced the budget. He doesn't say, when he left the governorships, in the governorship of Massachusetts, he left them in a $1.3 billion deficit. He doesn't say that when he came into the governorship, they were ranked number four in job creation, and when they left, they were 47th in job creation and 47th in education.
Heck of a job, Romney.
He doesn't say that when he came into office, he had 42% women in his cabinet, or in the top echelon of his government, but less, there was less than 20%. He doesn't say all these things.
Folder with some women's names or something.
Binders. It wasn't. It was a binder. It was a binder.
Name.
It was a. The Romney had plenty of binders. Binder. This is what really needs to be said. And the person who has said it very much like it should have been said.
Does the buck stop with your Secretary of State as far as what went on here?
Secretary Clinton has done an extraordinary job, but she works for me. I'm the president, and I'm always responsible. And that's why nobody's more interested in finding out exactly what happened than I did. The day after the attack, Governor, I stood in the Rose Garden and I told the American people and the world that we were going to find out exactly what happened, that this was an act of terror, and I also said that we're going to hunt down those who committed this crime. And then a few days later, I was there greeting the caskets coming into Andrews Air Force Base and grieving with the families. And the suggestion that anybody in my team, whether the Secretary of State, our UN ambassador, anybody on my team, would play politics or mislead when we've lost four of our own, Governor, is offensive. That's not what we do. That's not what I do as president. That's not what I do as commander-in-chief.
Governor, if you want to reflect
quickly. I think it's interesting. The president just said something which is that on the day after the attack, he went to the Rose Garden and said that this was an act of terror. You said in the Rose Garden, the day after the attack, it was an act of terror. It was not a spontaneous demonstration. Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
I want to make sure we get that for the record, because it took the president 14 days before he called the attack in Benghazi an act of terror.
Get the transcript.
He did, in fact, sir. So let me call it an act of
Can
terror.
Can you say that a little louder, Candy?
He did call it an act of terror.
The videotape doesn't lie. Candy Crowley and the president were correct.
No acts of terror will ever shake the resolve of this great nation, alter that character, or eclipse the light of the values that we stand for. Today we mourn for more Americans who represent the very best of the United States of America. We will not waver in our commitment to see that justice is done for this terrible act, and make no mistake, justice will be done.
In fact, President Obama was even more explicit about the act of terror a day later.
What I want all of you to know is that we are going to bring those who killed our fellow Americans to justice. I want people around the world to hear me, to all those who would do us harm. No act of terror will go unpunished. It will not dim the light of the values that we proudly present to the rest of the world.
No act of violence shakes the resolve of the United States of America.
Now, I want to thank Ed. That's from the Ed Schultz Show, that montage. But I, as I said, I wanted to play. You need to hear these things in the entirety instead of their little clips. He said act of terror twice. And then he said it, that was September 12th. And the following day, he said act of terror. And this shows you, we're talking about someone, the Mitster, who has the exact same group of neocon, well, I can't use that word, neocon pinheads around him that were around George W. Bush that led George W. Bush into a war.
Right.
Two wars. That led him, the same people, Senor, who is the chief foreign advisor for Bush, who was the chief architect over there in the failed execution of the Iraqi occupation that lost, how much money was it that was shipped in there by the planes? Gold?
$10 billion.
He was in charge of the Iraqi government when that went in, when that money went missing. These are the same people that could not identify where that money went. Where is that money? That money is still missing. Tens of billions of dollars. So, and people, if you don't know, that money was shipped over there in dollar bills. $5 bills, $100 bills.
Who ordered it?
And who ordered it?
Dick Cheney, as a matter of fact. When they were going to ship it, if you go back and look at it, when they investigated later and came out, he actually even changed it. They were going to ship it in trackable money to see where it flowed so that they could track the networks, terror networks, and he demanded it be untraceable, all serial numbers untraceable. Because he said they had to freely be able to give and pay people and not have them under any kind of a threat of being tracked or followed or anything else. But then magically it vanished. Now, ain't that something?
Yeah. Well, do you think any of it got back to Halliburton or she?
Yeah.
Is it she now they call?
You know, I couldn't even keep up with the Blackwater.
That's the Blackwater name change two or three times already. Now, how they wanted to track to see where this money went. Dick Cheney ordered them. Now, how did Dick Cheney get involved in the money or anything to do without the president's consent?
Well, listen.
Or without the Federal Reserve or with the Department of the Treasury or without the head of the Treasury knowing about this?
And this is something that, you know, if you heard Obama just say, and something that infuriates me, there's this Republican mantra that, you know, they're good on defense, that they're the true patriots, that they're the family values, all this. You know, he was saying, we protect American values, and America will not waver, no matter what happens to it. Okay, Obama is someone who steadfastly done so, even surprisingly successful in the war on terror. He has taken out all of the al-Qaeda leadership, of course, most famously Osama, but he's taken them all out across the board, Afghanistan, Pakistan, it's even gone into Yemen, it's gone into Ethiopia, it's gone into southern Sudan, all over the place. People, it should be shocking almost how successful he's been. But again, it's only shocking in the sense that their mantra is that they are successful. When you look at the reality of it and the values of it, you know, Obama went in, he has successfully truncated the war on terror. He has ended the two wars that were started, one of which had absolutely nothing to do. Iraq had nothing to do with it to begin with. The only excuse even to go into Afghanistan is that al-Qaeda was being sheltered there. But so you can, you know, argue whether or not you could even start a whole war with the country just to take out an organization. But either way, at least Afghanistan has the excuse. But he's ended both, right? On the other hand, now, this is a guy also who, do you remember when Obama came on TV having killed
Osama bin Laden.
As a matter of fact, I was, because I knew it was exactly that. I told it to my wife when he said it was a special report. The president was going to appear in, I don't know what room it was, down walking down the hallway. I said, I bet you they got Osama bin Laden. She said, no, it was something else.
Right.
I waited up. It was like 11:30
at
night.
The only time he's ever interrupted.
That's
anything.
Right.
He came
it was Sunday night, something I think it was.
Listen, here's the thing that struck me, though. He came down as commander-in-chief, gave a brief but forceful explanation what happened, explained to the American people, and said, this is, you know, this has occurred, it has been done.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The end. Did he go out in the Indian Ocean and prance around on the deck of the aircraft carrier where they flew back to and verified the remains and disposed of them? You know, did he go and do a dance on Osama, you know, and parade him around and show him off and have a big banner going, mission accomplished, as they dump the body down? Yeah, no. And see, that's the thing. Someone once said, Elliot Spitzer, as a matter of fact, that the problem with the Republicans is that they're all razzle-dazzle, right? And that there's no...
Mostly dazzle, right? But no razzle.
And that's,
huh,
the thing that infuriates me. They have these ad campaigns that they're the responsible ones, ad campaigns that they're the militaristic, you know, they're the hawks. They have the ad campaigns that they're the values crowd, everything. What the hell? It infuriates me that they get away with that, because repeatedly they're razzle and there's no substance. It's all the mission accomplished. Look at me on the deck of the aircraft carrier when I'm taking month-long vacations when they blow down the Twin Towers. You know, look at me. I'm a cowboy because I built a fake ranch. And then when Putin came over and jumped on a horse, you remember that, and said, let's go ride? Bush couldn't even ride. He didn't know either.
My horse is 450 under the hood.
Yeah, exactly. It's all show. And this is exactly why, you know, the only thing militarily that, like, Cheney ever accomplished was blowing his friend's face off at a drunken party in Texas. The only thing that Bush ever accomplished militarily was, well, so anyway.
He had his picture taken in a uniform.
Yeah, he did. He did. He actually wore an aircraft uniform and a red speech or something. But, you know, Romney's accomplishment to date has been he bullied some poor child and shaved his hair off or something, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I, you know, he didn't even serve.
But it wasn't him by himself. It was him and his gang.
Well, yeah, it takes a gang because you can't do these things alone. You know, you can't be a bully by yourself. You might actually get beaten up.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, it's shameful. It infuriates me. When you have real leadership and you have the talk of leadership, you have real action, the talk of action. Obama gets things done. And
we had a really great show today, but I want to leave a closing tonight, which I think really put the point on the debate last night, Monday night.
I believe Governor Romney is a good man. He loves his family, cares about his faith. But I also believe that when he said behind closed doors that 47% of the country considered themselves victims who refused personal responsibility. Think about who he was talking about. Folks on Social Security who worked all their lives. Veterans who sacrificed for this country. Students who are out there trying to hopefully advance their own dreams, but also this country's dreams. Soldiers who are overseas fighting for us right now. People who are working hard every day, paying payroll tax, gas taxes, but don't make enough income. And I want to fight for them. That's what I've been doing for the last 4 years, because if they succeed, I believe the country succeeds.
I want to thank everybody today and all our guests and
also Our Lady of Consolation
for hosting us. And Father Carl and Valerie and George, hope you were listening. And Angela Winthrop. And when you get that degree, you can go see your Uncle George and help him in New York, because he needs it. All right. This has been The Last Word. I'm Michael Lawson. Next week, next Friday. See you.